Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
Canada. We should move to Canada.
My name is Julia Dorfman, and I'm a parent of a JK student in downtown Toronto. My son's been learning online since January, but he's four, so he can't actually learn from a screen or without interacting with an adult. And in my mind, remote learning is leaving these kids behind. And families are really, really struggling. It just feels like no one is advocating for our kids at all. And I get it. It's hard. This is a hard situation, and it's messy, and it's tricky. But that's the government's job, and they need to do better.
Across the country, many families have been frustrated by the mix of online and in-person schooling. Ontario is now the only province where the majority of students are at home. Meanwhile, in Quebec, students are back in the class, despite COVID numbers that are similar to Ontario's. Toronto's Hospital for Sick Children says Quebec has made the right move. The hospital published a new report on in-person learning last week and the benefits of keeping kids in class. Dr. Ronald Cohn is the president and CEO of Sick Kids. Dr. Daphne Korchek is a child and adolescent psychiatrist and an associate scientist at the hospital. Good morning to you both.
Good morning. Good morning. Thank you for having us.
Thanks for joining us. Dr. Cohn, this new report is an update to the guidelines that SickKids published for school reopening in September. Just briefly, what's changed between now and then?
I think what has mainly changed in terms of the document is that we have added a fairly robust section around new recommendations for robust test and tracing strategy that we feel is important really in two ways. On one hand, it will allow us to detect cases that are happening in school that might be transmitted between children, among children, or between children and teachers and vice versa, and how much of that is then being brought back into the community. So there are some data that we really have not had on hand that are important. At the same time, it will maybe also help to identify certain areas where we have to make some changes to some of these bundled measures of infection prevention and control.
Do we know how much spread of COVID there has been in schools?
We don't. That is exactly one of the problems that is particularly a problem when community transmission is higher as it is right now than when it was lower during the fall when schools opened. And really, by and large, this has gone in most schools very well. But we don't have the data. We need these data in order to safely open schools and keep the schools open.
Dr. Korchek, the report emphasizes the mental health challenges that children are facing right now. I mean, anecdotally, I think we have all heard stories of kids struggling. What have you found?
Well, in our study of over 1,000 parents and 350 children in Ontario during the first lockdown, we found that roughly 70% of children experienced deterioration of their mental health, and that the biggest predictor of mental health problems was the degree of social isolation that children experienced. So, you know, here we are in a second lockdown, and children are without in-person school or sports or activities or the ability to get together with their friends. And these are all factors that increase social isolation. And that's really what we're seeing in the clinic as well as anecdotally that way.
I was going to say in the clinic, I mean, what do you hear from parents about how their children are doing?
You know, one of the biggest concerns that I'm hearing parents say is this is changing who my child is. You know, my child used to be a child who was very happy, social, physically fit, maybe eager to learn. And now my child seems timid, is nervous when they come across new people, isn't active, isn't motivated to participate in school, isn't excited about the day anymore. So, you know, a year is a very long time in a child's life. And these are concerns from parents that because of the public health restrictions that we've put in place, that we're changing children's trajectories and changing who their child is.
And so given that, Dr. Cohn, what needs to be done so that schools can open safely?
I think what needs to be done now, in addition to implementing the robust testing tracing strategy that I mentioned, yeah. is that we have to really, in a very precise and targeted way, look at the schools who have had struggles implementing the bundled measures of infection prevention and control. I think our teachers, all of our teachers and school boards and schools have gone above and beyond and have done an outstanding job. But we do know that there are some schools who have struggled to implement these measures. And these are the schools that really need now targeted support, creative thinking, creative solutions, because most often these are schools that are in communities of already high community transmission and are communities where our children and the families who live there are already vulnerable. We have seen the health inequities come to the forefront in a very dramatic fashion. And this is what needs to happen now, that particularly schools who are struggling get the support they need.
So let me ask you just briefly about a couple of specific things. One is the testing. We know that Ontario has a stockpile of something like 4 million rapid tests. Should those have been deployed already? Do they need to be deployed now?
They should definitely be deployed for one of the testing strategies as we think about asymptomatic surveillance testing, particularly in schools where community transmission is very high. We see the value for these rapid tests in these circumstances. There's another part of the testing strategy that I don't want to get lost in the discussion, in that we need to robustly test asymptomatic children who have had an exposure at school. That has not been happening. Most of the time, school classes are being sent home, isolate for 14 days, and we only test children and or teachers who become symptomatic. Here we need to really focus on anybody who had an exposure, even if not symptomatic, should get testing after about 5 to 7 days of the exposure. So we understand whether any kind of transmission actually occurred in school.
The other issue, and it's been raised by the unions that represent many teachers, is that in a classroom, if you have 25 or 30 students, as many schools in the Greater Toronto area may have and elsewhere as well, that you can't have the physical distancing that is necessary to prevent the spread of the disease. How important is something like a smaller class size to ensure a safe return to school?
I think it's critically important to create an environment where you can maintain physical distancing. So rather than landing on a specific number, it has to be, 15 is the number that we are often hearing about. We need to create an environment where physical distancing can be maintained, whether that means 15 children or 10 children. Or I can tell you anecdotally, I've received a few phone calls over the last few months from a few teachers saying, I can have 18 children in my class. Would that be fine if they're all distant? And we believe that that would be fine. So the focus really needs to be on strong physical distancing. And again, it comes back to what I said earlier. The schools where that has not been possible need now the support in order to facilitate this.
Ontario is the outlier, as I was saying earlier in this. Quebec, for example, has prioritized keeping schools open since the very beginning of this pandemic, and infection rates there are similar to Ontario. Take a listen to Aaron Strumpf, who's an epidemiologist at McGill University in Montreal.
Around the same time that young kids were going back to school, we put in place a curfew and closed all non-essential businesses. Having kids go back to school was really the priority, and we made sacrifices in other places to allow that to happen. And I think it's really crucial to remember that there are a lot of kids who get their meals at school. You know, that's a safe environment, and it's a small sacrifice for the rest of us to make.
Dr. Cohn and Dr. Korshak, I want to get to the meals point in a moment, but Dr. Cohn, what is it that Quebec knows that Ontario doesn't?
I don't think that Quebec knows anything different than we know here in Ontario, but I think, you know, we have spoken about the principle of schools being the last doors to close and the first doors to open, and it is upon us as a society, individually, and government to embrace this in a similar fashion, to say we want our kids to be the priority and we are going to put them before anything else. And I think that's kind of the decision we have to make over the next few weeks.
Dr. Korchak, in part that's about education, but as Aaron Strump said, it's also beyond that as well. Just from your perspective briefly, what do schools provide beyond education that some people may not realize and that is missing because kids aren't in the classroom?
Yeah, that's an excellent point. School is about much more than just learning in class. There are the elements that are the fun times for kids. There are the gym class and music class and drama and recess, and there are clubs and activities. For some kids, those are the elements that give kids their identities, their self-confidence. They're the reason to go to school every day. And those elements are largely absent when kids aren't in school in person, or they're significantly altered. And school is also about connections. It's about connecting with friends, with teachers, in groups, working together in groups. And those online interactions really just don't approximate in-person connections for most children.
One of the reasons, Dr. Cohn, why schools aren't open and why people continue to raise concerns is because of the case counts in Ontario. There is growing concern, not just around the new variants of COVID, particularly in Ontario, but also just around the fact that there are stubbornly high case counts. They're starting to go down, but they're still in the thousands per day. Biostatistician Ryan Imgren has continued sounding the alarm about the risks of in-person learning and COVID spread. Here is what he had to say about that.
I think the one thing that may throw a loop into everything is the fact that there is this new UK variant, which we know is more highly transmissible within the younger population. It's very important that the guidelines are implemented as close as possible to what is recommended.
Dr. Cohn, if there is a new variant that is highly transmissible, particularly among a younger population, is it still safe to open schools?
First of all, it's correct that this, particularly this new variant of B1.1.7 is highly more transmissible, but it really is more transmissible across all ages, not just children. What we know as of today is that the public health measures that are in place and the bundled recommendations of health and safety that are outlined in our document are able to protect you from getting infected and from transmitting it. It is therefore possible to open schools if we really are able to implement all these measures, and then it can be done safely.
Do you think there's the political will to implement those measures?
I hope there is.
And Dr. Korchak, if there isn't, what's at stake in terms of the mental health risks of not returning to in-person learning? Do they outweigh the physical health risks that we were just talking about?
No, we've certainly seen that the societal response to the pandemic, that is, the public health measures that have been put in place in response to the pandemic, are more harmful to children than COVID itself. I think the concern is from our preliminary data, we see that the increased mental health symptoms that kids had during the first lockdown have persisted through the summer and into the early fall. And this tells us that children went into the second lockdown in a different place from where they were going into the first lockdown. They're going into this second lockdown less resilient than they used to be. And the concerns are, what that looks like, the magnitude of that impact and the duration of that impact, the longer that this continues.
It's good to speak with you both about this. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having us.
Dr. Daphne Korchak is a child and adolescent psychiatrist and associate scientist at SickKids Hospital in Toronto. Dr. Ronald Conan, the president and CEO of that hospital. We did ask to speak with the Ontario Education Minister, Stephen Lecce. He wasn't available today, but we're hoping to speak with him about getting kids back into the classroom in the coming days. In the meantime, how are your kids doing at school?
Where are you in Ohio?
Central Ohio.
Okay, is that near Mansfield, Columbus?
Even as President Biden's team is ramping up plans for production of COVID vaccines, there were also sober warnings that it will take well through the summer to vaccinate enough Americans. Here is CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky.
Now is the time to remain vigilant. If we continue on the current trajectory, The CDC most recent national ensemble forecast predicts that 479,000 to 514,000 COVID-19 deaths will be reported by February 20th, 2021. But if we are united in action, we can turn things around. Continuing to expand safe, effective vaccination is key to ending the COVID-19 pandemic and bringing our country back to health.
The U.S. is by no means the only country struggling with vaccine supply and demand. Today, a battle escalated between the EU and vaccine maker AstraZeneca. Back here, there are major concerns over vaccine supply and equity. Stephanie Tsai looks at has our report.
Judy, a recent analysis by Kaiser Health News finds Black and Latino citizens are getting vaccines at significantly lower rates in a number of states, especially worrying given the major disparities in death rates, which public health officials reminded us again of today. As you can see on this chart, Black, Indigenous, and Latino people are dying at a much higher rate than white people. Here to talk about these equity concerns, I'm joined by Dr. Myshika Roberts, the Public Health Commissioner of Columbus, Ohio. Dr. Roberts, thank you so much for joining us. I know you've been focused on these issues. And in fact, I've heard you say in the past that there in Columbus, public health officials have an equity agenda. What does that mean in practical terms?
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. And yeah, here in Columbus, Ohio, our mayor, Mayor Andy Ginther, has an equity agenda for our city. And it does involve health. And he has declared racism as a public health issue, which has really caused my department, as well as many health agencies in town, to focus their work on looking at the health inequities that exist and how we can work to overcome them.
What does that mean in terms of the current vaccination program? For example, are you going directly to those neighborhoods, those Black and brown communities where the vaccine is needed the most? Are you deploying mobile clinics at this point to bring the vaccine to those that might not be able to access it?
Well, really, we're doing all of the above that you mentioned. So here in our community is no different than across the nation. Black and brown individuals have been disproportionately impacted by COVID-19, whether that's in cases, hospitalizations, or even deaths. So it's more important than ever that we also get that same population vaccinated with the new COVID-19 vaccine. So we are really putting boots on the ground. We're working with grassroots organizations, trying to get the message out that these vaccines are safe and effective, who should get the vaccine, and when the vaccine is available for those groups. We're also doing some mobile clinics where we're going to those neighborhoods. We're going to those organizations where we know have a large population of Black and brown individuals, and we're providing those vaccines for them at a location that's convenient for them.
You know, you talk about misinformation, and I saw a video of you, Dr. Roberts, in which you felt the need to say that the vaccine does not include a tracking device, which I think really speaks to the misinformation and conspiracy theories that are plaguing the vaccination efforts. How big of a challenge is that there?
Well, I think the misinformation is a huge challenge across the nation. But yeah, there are some people who think that when we say the vaccine includes nanoparts, nanoproteins, which in the healthcare field just means very small, some people have interpreted that as nanotechnology and that the vaccine actually has the ability to track people. So they don't want to get vaccinated because they think by getting vaccinated, the government can now track them. And I remind people all the time that the smartphones that we use every day can track you much more effectively than any vaccine that we could provide.
And of course, Dr. Roberts, when it comes to the mistrust in the Black community, there is a history of mistreatment, whether it came to the Tuskegee experiment or Henrietta Lacks. How do you counter that history and rebuild that trust?
Well, first, I think we have to acknowledge the history and acknowledge that Black and brown individuals have a reason to distrust or mistrust our healthcare community. And then we have to let them know that because of those incidents, because of Tuskegee, because of Henrietta Lacks, so much has changed in our healthcare arena to protect individuals that look like me and to protect everyone. And so that's why we have informed consent now. That's some of the reason why we have HIPAA, is to protect our health information and to make sure people understand if they're taking a risk, what that risk might be. And so, one, we have to acknowledge it. Then we have to let them know that this vaccine has gone through all the safety measures. The vaccines we have on the market now are available for anyone over the age of 16 or 18, depending on the product you're looking at. And these vaccines are being given to everyone, whether you're white, black, brown, or purple. And so first, just identifying, though, why they have that mistrust and acknowledging that, and then telling them how our community has changed as a result of those incidents that plagued our communities.
I just want to ask one quick question broadly of how the vaccination efforts are going there. I understand that you're now in the phase where you're offering the vaccine to those 75 and older, as well as some people with disabilities, congenital medical disorders. How is it all going? What can be improved?
Well, I think from my perspective, what we're doing at Columbus Public Health, it's going well. We would all love to have more vaccines, and obviously we'd love to be able to vaccinate everyone. We do have this phased-in approach that our state put in place, and we're following that. Next week, we will start vaccinating staff that work in K-12 schools, so we're getting a lot more doses of the vaccine next week to accommodate that population. But like everyone's saying across the country, if we had more vaccines, we could vaccinate more people.
So many priorities you're juggling. Dr. Myshika Roberts, thank you so much for joining us with the perspective from Columbus, Ohio.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
White supremacy is the sickness.
The White House has warned that it could take months for everyone who wants the COVID-19 vaccine to get it. To date, just over 6% of adults in the U.S. have gotten at least one dose. And within that 6%, a disproportionately small number of Black and Hispanic people who've been hardest hit in the pandemic. Samantha Artiga is director of the Racial Equity and Health Policy Program at the Kaiser Family Foundation, and she's been tracking the vaccine rollout. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Thanks so much for having me, Ari.
First, give us an overview of what you're seeing in these numbers. How disproportionate are the vaccination rates compared to the infection and death rates when you look at it by race?
So what we're seeing from the states that are currently reporting data on vaccination distribution by race and ethnicity is a consistent pattern that is really showing a mismatch between who's receiving the vaccine and who has been hardest hit by the pandemic. So, for example, if we look at a state like Mississippi, we see that 15% of vaccinations have been received by Black people in the state, whereas they've accounted for 38% of cases and 42% of deaths. Similarly, if we look at Texas, we see that 15% of vaccinations have gone to Hispanic people in the state, while they make up 44% of cases and nearly half of deaths in the state. So those are some large disparities that we're looking at. Although I would note that the data are still early and there are a lot of gaps and limitations associated with it.
You know, here in Washington, D.C., the health department has been narrowing vaccine signups by zip code to try to target less affluent, less white neighborhoods where the pandemic is having the harshest toll. What kinds of creative approaches have you heard of in other parts of the country to try to remedy this discrepancy that we're seeing?
So we are increasingly hearing that areas are adding new vaccination sites and adopting new sign-up processes to help make the vaccine more available for people. So as you noted, DC is prioritizing certain wards for appointments based on some of the early data that were showing disparities in who was able to access the vaccine. I believe there are some health systems in areas that are planning to provide appointments based on lottery systems when vaccines become available. I'm hearing now of some mobile vaccine clinics that are going into operation to go directly into communities. And there are other areas that are also beginning to adopt this approach of targeting specific geographic areas that we know have been hardest hit by the pandemic and may have more limited resources to be able to navigate sign-up processes for vaccines.
I know that you tweeted a photo of your mother getting vaccinated and talked about how that personal experience fits into the larger policy implications that you spend all day thinking about. Can you tell us about that moment and what it meant to you?
That moment was really meaningful for me. I think as I was going through that process, I could not help but be struck by how our ability to reach that point was so dependent on the resources I had available to me in terms of access to the internet, email to be able to receive the alerts, time to be able to focus on getting her through the sign-up process, flexibility in my work schedule to be able to take her to that appointment. And to me, it just really raised the concerns about how many people may be left behind if those are the resources that are required to access the vaccine. And going forward, I think it's going to be really important to ensure that all individuals can have access to the vaccine regardless of the resources that they have available. And so really intentional focus on reducing access barriers will be an important part of efforts to achieve that.
You know, I'm thinking about the challenge of setting up this national vaccination campaign that has to administer literally hundreds of millions of doses and layering on top of that a need to make it accessible to people who might not have a vehicle, who might not have easy access to the internet. I mean, how important is it to front load those accessibility issues if you're going to make this campaign work?
So I really think the early data and what we know about people's willingness and concerns related to the vaccine point to the importance of having a multi-pronged approach that is seeking to address access barriers and provide information and education to help address people's questions and concerns. And I think that we also can learn a lot by listening directly to communities about how and where they want to access the vaccine, where they will feel comfortable accessing the vaccine, and who they want information from about safety of the vaccine.
Samantha Artiga is Director of the Racial Equity and Health Policy Program at the Kaiser Family Foundation. Thanks a lot.
Thanks so much, Ari.
A terrible thing to waste. Environmental racism and its assault on the American mind. Written by Harriet A. Washington.
People of color in this country are much more likely to breathe polluted air and drink polluted water. The Biden administration promises to change that, starting with an executive order the president signed this week.
With this executive order, environmental justice will be at the center of all we do, addressing the disproportionate health and environmental and economic impacts on communities of color, so-called fence line communities, especially those communities, brown, black, Native American, poor whites.
But Biden is not the first president to make such a promise. Rebecca Hersher from NPR's climate team is here with more. Good morning.
Good morning.
What did Biden do with this new executive order?
So the order creates a White House Council on Environmental Justice so that council will suggest ways that the federal government can address the environmental impacts of systemic racism. And remember, the government helped create this situation. You know, discriminatory housing and zoning policies, they are the reason that people of color are more likely to live near power plants and refineries and highways, you know, things that release a lot of pollution.
Right.
So the federal government is promising to undo some of that.
The federal government has promised such before, right? I mean, this isn't the first time a president has acknowledged the responsibility by signing an executive order. What's going to be different?
Honestly, you know, Biden's approach is not very different from what past presidents have done. All the way back in 1994, President Clinton signed an executive order that also created a special group to work on environmental justice. But progress has been really slow since then. You know, overall, air and water quality in the U.S. have gotten better. But the places that were most polluted in the 90s are basically the same places that are most polluted now. And that's deadly. You know, neighborhoods where people of color are exposed to chronic pollution, they're also the neighborhoods with some of the highest mortality rates from COVID-19 and some of the most severe damage from climate-driven disasters. So there are layers of environmental racism here, and they have not been fixed despite decades of federal promises.
So what's been the effect of that, all those unmet promises on people living in these places with a lot of pollution?
You know, people are frustrated. When you see a lot of promises, it makes you wary of new promises. I talked to a man named Devon Hall about this. He runs a local anti-pollution group in North Carolina. Specifically, they're trying to cut down on pollution from hog farms. So the feces from the farms, it gets into the air and the water. It makes people sick. And black people are hit the hardest.
If you look at the maps, I mean, you begin to look at where the facility is located, it's pretty much in communities of color.
So Hall has been trying to reduce this pollution for more than 20 years. Regulators have acknowledged it's a problem, acknowledged that black people are the ones who are suffering, even said that what's happening in Hall's home county violates the Civil Rights Act. but the pollution is still happening. And I asked Hall, like, what would he say to the new administration? And he had some questions that he thinks people in power should really ask themselves.
How do you give a voice to the voiceless? How do you give those people a platform to voice their concerns? And then who's going to have a listening ear? And how long will you listen to those people crying out?
He says, frankly, actions speak louder than words.
Right. So is there a specific action the Biden administration could take beyond this executive order?
Yeah. So Vice President Kamala Harris sponsored an environmental justice bill when she was a senator that could give more power to people like Hall. That bill could have more life now that Democrats control the Senate. And the Biden administration is also planning to spend trillions of dollars on pandemic recovery and climate change. That means jobs, infrastructure, healthcare investments. So a lot of people are watching to see if that money is spent equitably.
Rebecca Hersher with NPR's climate team. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
A cry for racial justice, some 400 years in the making, moves us. The dream of justice for all will be deferred no longer. A cry for survival comes from the planet itself, a cry that can't be any more desperate or any more clear. And now, a rise of political extremism, white supremacy, domestic terrorism, that we must confront and we will defeat. To overcome these challenges, to restore the soul and secure the future of America, requires so much more than words. It requires the most elusive of all things in a democracy, unity. Unity.
All right, we're going to take a closer look now at the housing issue. The Biden administration says the federal government needs to do a better job of acknowledging the ways that communities of color are blocked from fair and equal access to housing. Andre Perry is a senior fellow in the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution, where he studies race and housing. Andre, thanks so much for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So what do you make of this executive order? Is it going to make the changes that you want to see?
Well, first, it's a start. We haven't heard or seen equity mentioned as much as any president as it has been uttered by Biden in just the first month of being in office. So introducing values is important. This executive order on housing also directs the HUD secretary to essentially enforce discrimination under that occurs under its purview. So it's a great start. The problem with it is that housing entails so many different regulatory agencies, so many different jurisdictions that HUD may not be able to reach many of the issues that hurts Black, Brown, and Asian people. And so so it's a good start. It's more than symbolic, but I'm happy to see it.
Yeah. I want to pick up on something you said, that the order is going to push HUD to fully enforce the Fair Housing Act. Can you explain how the Fair Housing Act has been neglected or not enforced?
Oh, man. When it comes to discrimination, there's some obvious sort of things that occur on the daily. So there's rental discrimination. Landlords consistently discriminate against Black, Brown, and Asian folk. We also see steering in from real estate agents, and that's the practice where real estate agents direct potential buyers towards one neighborhood, whether they're Black or white, depending on the neighborhood. There's also harassment claims that essentially come from particularly from landlords. And this is occurring right now because of COVID. So many renters have not been able to pay and they've received significant harassment. So over the last 4 years, you have essentially not seen any enforcement. Mm-hmm. Ben Carson and HUD essentially been sitting on their collective hands when it comes to these issues. So this is a welcome action on the part of Biden to say, hey, we have at least have to enforce the rules on the book. But there's another issue. Equity is not just about fairness. It's also about material losses. Hmm. The executive order doesn't really touch on how we're going to recoup those material losses from historic discrimination.
Some part of this problem lies outside federal control, right? As you have mentioned, practices from mortgage lenders, discriminatory practices that banks have carried out, real estate agents and that industry. How do you start to address those issues?
Yeah, you know, again, housing involves the Federal Housing Finance Agency, the OCC, Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, the Fed Reserve. There's so many agencies. My issue that's mentioned in the memo regarding housing is in terms of housing devaluation has a lot to do with real estate agent behavior, has a lot to do with appraisals, has a lot to do with lending, none of which HUD really has a good hold on. And so I do think this is a start. You have to start somewhere. You start with HUD. And hopefully momentum from the public can encourage these other areas to make change. Remember, much of the redlining, the Federal Highway Administration work and the creation of the interstate highway system, all these different things, there was complicity with municipalities in terms of zoning. And so we're going to ask for those same co-conspirators to be on the side of justice in this case. So they need to take on some of Biden's equity value.
Andre Perry, he's the author of Know Your Price, Valuing Black Lives and Property in America's Black Cities. He's also a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
You know, my daddy told me a long time ago, no matter who's the president, you got to get up and go to work in the morning. And always remember that. So no matter who's the president, I'm going to get up and go to work in the morning.
President Biden has said racial justice is one of his top priorities. And today he signed four executive actions. He says they are some of his first steps to addressing systemic racism.
We need to open the promise of America to every American. And that means we need to make the issue of racial equity not just an issue for any one department of government. It has to be the business of the whole of government.
Even before he signed those orders today, some advocates for racial justice were saying they worry the actions don't go far enough. Joining us now is NPR White House correspondent Aisha Roscoe. Hi, Aisha.
Hello.
To begin with, describe what the president signed today.
Today's announcement, it is somewhat limited in scope. It's not as expansive as some were expecting. The one that may have some impact on mass incarceration is that Biden is directing the Justice Department to not renew contracts with private prisons. This is something that the Obama administration was going to do. Then the Trump administration reversed it. So the Biden White House is going back to that plan. Also, he's directing HUD, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, to advance fair housing laws. And there is an action about respecting tribal sovereignty and fighting a rise in anti-Asian discrimination that we've seen in this past year.
The president talked about how George Floyd's death at the hands of police this summer marked a turning point in attitudes toward racial justice. But today's actions don't address policing. Why not?
So that's obviously a top-of-mind issue, especially for activists. Today's announcements don't address that at all, the president's top advisor on domestic issues, Susan Rice, told reporters that there are more things in the works. She said there will be actions on criminal justice issues, including policing, in coming weeks.
We have 1,454 more days left in President Biden's first term. And so give us a little something to do over the next few days.
Rice is also leading a broad review of all federal programs to find ways to address these sorts of issues.
You've been talking with advocates about what they want the Biden administration to do, what they're pushing for. What are you hearing from them?
Part of what Biden promised to do on the campaign trail was a new commission on policing. We haven't heard the details on that yet, but advocates are already concerned about this approach. I talked about this yesterday with Breon Wells. He's a political strategist focused on ending mass incarceration. He said it's too soon to pass judgment, but he pointed out that the Obama White House already had a commission that studied policing. Here's more from him.
So for us, the commission is not a solution. A new commission is not a solution for us. It's time to very much start to move forward in some of the things that we do know.
Wells wants clear accountability for officers who engage in misconduct. He also said that while ending contracts with privately run prisons is a step in the right direction, he said the administration needs to also end privately run detention centers for people facing deportation. Those detention centers run by the Department of Homeland Security are not addressed by these actions.
And in the weeks ahead, beyond a possible commission on policing, what else do you expect might be coming?
The administration is expected to take action on demilitarizing the police, you know, ending those programs that give local departments serious military equipment that we see at these protests. And there are some advocates who are hoping that the White House will push for a legislation that will go further in dealing with sentencing and standards for policing.
It's NPR White House correspondent Aisha Roscoe. Thank you.
Thank you.
And yes, together we will make America great again. Thank you, God bless you, and God bless America.
The chairman of the hate group, the Proud Boys, identifies as Afro-Cuban. One of the organizers of the pro-Trump extremist group Stop the Steal is black and Arab. Christina Beltran is a professor of social and cultural analysis at New York University, and she uses the term multiracial whiteness to explain why some groups who are disdained by white supremacists embrace white power movements. And she joins us now to explain. Welcome to the program.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
So what do you mean by multiracial whiteness?
So there's been a whole lot of people thinking and theorizing about white supremacy. And all of these scholars share a view that I share, that whiteness is not the same thing as white people, and that whiteness is actually better understood as a political project that has emerged historically and that is dynamic and that is always changing. And so whiteness as an ideology is rooted in America's history of white supremacy, right, which has to do with the legacy of slavery or indigenous dispossession or Jim Crow. And I think it's important to realize just how long in this country legal discrimination was not simply culturally acceptable, but legally authorized. And so we've only been practicing a more consistent form of legal equality for a relatively short time since the 1960s. So Americans have often learned how to create their own sense of belonging through violence and through the exclusion of certain groups and populations.
So what you're saying essentially is that people of other races and ethnicities want to benefit from white privilege by supporting it.
Right.
So we should note that you wrote an op-ed recently in the Washington Post about this, and it stirred up a heated debate on social media.
Yeah.
I want to read what you wrote in part. For voters who see the very act of acknowledging one's racial identity as itself racist, the politics of multiracial whiteness reinforces their desired approach to colorblind individualism. Can you explain what you mean?
Sure. I think that one of the things that's interesting about the politics of multicultural conservatism, for example, is that multicultural conservatism, which is the kind of conservative politics of reaching out to other racial minorities practiced by folks like Jack Kemp or George W. Bush, was an effort to recognize the specific histories and backgrounds of particular racial populations and to say that they could be part of the GOP. And I think that one of the things that's interesting is that there's a segment of people of color who don't necessarily want to be recognized at all. They don't want to be recognized for their racial distinctiveness, right? That for them, the very act of sort of identifying them as Latino, as African American, that they themselves have a certain discomfort with that very logic. They want to be understood as simply Americans outside of those kinds of identity categories.
And surely you can't be saying that every person who doesn't want to be all in with identity politics is somehow supporting white supremacy.
No, not at all. And I think this is one of the things that was sort of interesting about the difficulty sometimes in trying to kind of explain what whiteness is as an ideology. People vote for candidates for all kinds of reasons. But certainly there is, I think, a certain kind of critique of identity politics that actually makes the fact of not doing identity politics very attractive to a certain kind of conservative.
I mean, that is the argument among some conservatives, many conservatives actually, that identity politics is divisive, that ultimately what it does is it segments the population according to their various identities and is actually not unifying. And this is a country that is indeed very divided.
Yeah. And I think that one of the big political divides we face right now is people who find the very act of talking about those histories of racial exclusion as divisive. Because the act of talking about it and acknowledging it produces a kind of defensiveness or anger. And even discussing it, the idea that unity should be practiced from sort of not engaging with our history, not sort of celebrating the best stuff and not really acknowledging that we have a complicated, beautiful, tragic, inspiring inheritance that we have to understand to go forward.
Why do you think looking at our current politics through this lens would help the deep divisions of our current moment?
What I actually find helpful about theorizing and talking about whiteness as understanding that the politics of whiteness is distinct from white people is I think it actually opens up and expands our political possibilities going forward because we're not actually trapped in our identities or our demographics. It means that white citizens can, and many are, rejecting the politics of whiteness and working with communities of color to forge a multiracial democracy. But we have to understand this complicated and tragic and also beautiful shared inheritance we have. If we want to build something new together, we have to understand where we've come from.
Cristina Beltran is a professor of social and cultural analysis at New York University. Her new book is called Cruelty as Citizenship, How Migrants' Suffering Sustains White Democracy. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
20th anniversary of CUAPB. Thank you, Michelle Gross of Communities United Against Police Brutality in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I congratulate you all for reaching the 20th anniversary. Even as I recognize, it is a shame that you should have to fight something as basic as government repression and violence for so long. It is a statement of the serious failure of our existent political systems that such a problem can continue to exist for so long. I'm reminded of the words of Thomas Paine, who in his booklet, Common Sense, published in 1776, decried the evils of the British colonial government over the Americans. Paine wrote, "Society in every state is a blessing, but government, even in its best state, is but a necessary evil. In its worst state, an intolerable one. For when we suffer or are exposed to the same miseries by a government, which we might expect in a country without government, our calamity is heightened by reflecting that we furnish the means by which we suffer." Thomas Paine, Common Sense, page 3. Please let me repeat that line from Paine. We furnish the means by which we suffer. Let me put it another way, in modern day language. We pay the taxes for the very systems that repress us. Now let me put that another way. We pay for our own repression. A political season has just passed in which so-called conservatives tried to make political hay by calling forth signs that they saw at anti-police brutality protests across the country, saying, "Defund the police." This, they said, was radical, socialist, or Marxist. How many radicals turn to the words of Thomas Paine or Common Sense? His words resonate through time. First published in February 1776, and bears repeating today. We furnish the means by which we suffer. Thomas Paine was the founding father that the elites hated, for he was an American revolutionary, and indeed later a French revolutionary and member of the National Assembly of France. He owned no slaves nor plantations. In fact, he opposed slavery and supported Social Security. He also opposed the death penalty. If he were alive today, he would be supporting the Black Lives Matter movement, I think, as well as the movement against police brutality and government repression. He, being a bright, uplifting spirit, would also, I think, be supportive of Communities United Against Police Brutality in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I thank you all for your time. On the move from Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Thank you again.
I want to be a cop. Can you keep your lips sealed? I think with leadership skills can turn low-level offenders into crisp bills. You know, I've always wanted to be a cop. With a uniform fit, we're calm to the seams. Peeing in niggas, call the greens, and they discuss the politics of dreams. This is why I've always wanted to be a cop. So I can criminalize the gate in your stroll, the shade in your mold, and take a toll. A displaced dark face as safe as an ace in a hole for a cop. As good as I, a book of guy for drinking crooked eye. Don't resist a pudding pie, you think I won't, but why wouldn't I? I'm a cop.
And I'm Elsa Chang. We know a number of off-duty police took part in the Trump rally on January 6th, which turned into a siege on the U.S. Capitol. A Houston officer who allegedly entered the Capitol now faces federal charges. He has resigned. And other police departments are investigating whether any of their officers broke the law in Washington, D.C. But they're also deciding if the events at the Capitol change where to draw the line for officers when it comes to politics and free speech. NPR's Martin Costi reports.
As far as we know, the biggest contingent of off-duty cops at that rally came from Seattle. At least five officers. They're being investigated, and there's no public evidence yet that they broke the law. Still, alarm bells are going off for some people in the city.
What more can we do to help understand how deep the iceberg really is here?
Douglas Wagoner is a member of the Community Police Commission, a citizen advisory group which discussed the matter in a Zoom meeting.
Because I can't think of anything that's more problematic for trust between SPD and the community, especially at this already tenuous moment, than to find out that there are potential officers potentially involved in this attempted coup.
Another member of the group, a black officer named Mark Mullins, talked about colleagues who've worn MAGA hats to the precinct.
To me, that's like wearing a Confederate flag or bringing a Confederate flag to work.
Underneath this discussion, there's a deeper question. Is it still acceptable for cops to be pro-Trump? It's not a call that Andrew Meyerberg wants to make. He runs Seattle's Office of Police Accountability, which is investigating the five officers. His focus is on whether they broke the law in Washington, not the beliefs that took them there.
I think people are entitled to their political views, and I don't think it is my job to be policing those political views unless there is some component of it that clearly violates SPD policy.
At the same time, Meyerberg says it's no secret that police are often more conservative than the community.
It certainly creates friction when law enforcement is policing a city that's as progressive as Seattle or Washington, D.C. or Portland. There is this natural friction there.
Context often plays a role in whether a cop's political views are acceptable. Georgetown Law Professor Christy Lopez is an expert in this area. She says courts apply a balancing test. A police officer's free speech rights on one side, and on the other, there's a police department's interest in protecting its reputation and legitimacy.
What does that tell us, for example, if an officer wants to wear a MAGA hat to a baseball game? Is that balancing test different on January 5th than it is on January 7th? Maybe. Maybe that's different after we have come to believe that Trump actually instigated an attack on the Capitol.
Lopez isn't saying that the balance has changed in that way, just that it could. With that in mind, some police officers are now scrubbing their social media just in case. Houston Police Officers Union President Doug Griffith says some cops there became concerned when the chief recently vowed to search for political extremists in the ranks.
We received several calls from our members asking, how is he going to do this? What does this mean? Does this mean if I like the Trump tweet that I'm going to be disciplined?
Griffith assured the officers that that would not happen, though he also gives them this advice.
If you can't post on your church bulletin board what you're going to put on Facebook or Twitter, then you probably shouldn't put it out there.
Griffith doesn't think the many Trump supporters in law enforcement, people like himself, now have to worry about being penalized for that support. But when it comes to drawing lines, he has one of his own. He says all officers, regardless of political sympathies, need to respect the nation's electoral process and the fact that Joe Biden is now the president. Martin Costi, NPR News.
It's called respect for our country. Many people have died. Many, many people. Many people are so horribly injured. I was at Walter Reed Hospital recently, and I saw so many great young people, and they're missing legs and they're missing arms, and they've been so badly injured. And they were fighting for our country. They were fighting for our flag. They were fighting for our national anthem. And for people to disrespect that by kneeling during the playing of our national anthem, I think is disgraceful.
On January 6th, Larry Rendell Brock Jr. stood on the floor of the United States Senate. He and thousands of others had attacked Congress and sacked the Capitol building. Brock was clad in a helmet and tactical gear. He held white zip-tie handcuffs in his right hand.
You have to understand, it's an I.O. war. We can't lose the I.O. war.
We're better than that. Yeah.
Information. Information operation.
Brock is a retired lieutenant colonel in the United States Air Force. He graduated from the Air Force Academy in 1989. And in a recently deleted LinkedIn profile, first reported by the New Yorker magazine, Brock described himself as having served as a flight commander with the 706th Fighter Squadron. He retired in 2014. And on Facebook, he once posted that he was preparing for a, quote, second civil war. According to NPR, in the weeks after President Biden's election victory, Brock posted, quote, "We are now under occupation by a hostile governing force." Brock was arrested and charged several days after the attack on the Capitol. Of more than 140 people charged so far, almost 20% have some current or former service connection to the military, according to an NPR analysis. In 2019, the Military Times polled active duty service members and found that more than 30% of white service members said they'd personally witnessed examples of white nationalism, such as white supremacist tattoos and Nazi-style salutes within the ranks. The Military Times reported that minority enlisted members reported witnessing such examples at even higher rates, more than 50%. Both numbers are up significantly from similar polls the Military Times fielded in 2017 and 2018. Concern over extremism in the military has made its way up the chain of command over the past several years, and it bubbled up again last week when, in his confirmation hearing, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin pledged to confront military extremism head on.
The job of the Department of Defense is to keep America safe from our enemies. But we can't do that if some of those enemies lie within our own ranks.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. And today, we're going to talk about far-right white nationalist extremism in the United States military. We'll put the problem into context. How severe is it, really? How does it endanger the country and the military itself? And what to do about it? Troops themselves told the Military Times in that 2019 poll that, quote, overall, white nationalists are a greater national security threat than both domestic terrorism with a connection to Islam as well as immigration, end quote. We'll start today with a veteran, Jerry Green, and what he experienced during his service. Green says he was appalled when he learned men and women with military connections had attacked the Capitol.
And the Constitution of the United States is what guides us, is what guides the military. And to do something like that as an ex-military person, a veteran, or as an active duty person, it's hard for me to again, to understand how you could convince yourself that this is the right thing to do.
Green spent 20 years in Army Special Operations. He's now director of outreach with Vote Vets, a progressive political organization. Green is African-American, and in the 1980s, he was stationed in Germany. And he remembers how a fellow service member warned that his close friend, a man named Andy, someone he spoke to every day, was a racist.
He said he receives a magazine from a hate group. I said, really? I said, how often does he get this magazine? He said, well, you know, every 2 weeks or every month. He said, I'm not sure. He said, but he has a stack of them in his wall locker in his room.
Green didn't believe it, so he confronted Andy.
You know, he said, yeah, you know, I do get that magazine. He said, but, you know, it's not it's not about black people. It's about Jews. He said, you know, the Jews are taking over. They're doing all this stuff in America, and people don't know it. And we need to be aware of all the stuff they're doing. And it's Jews. It's the Jews who are doing that. I stayed another 2 or 3 minutes after that, and then I left.
That was in the 1980s. So decades later, Green recalled stories like that as he watched the attack on the Capitol in horror.
It makes me wonder if there were more, and I know there were more, but it makes me wonder if there were more close associates of mine, who I still associate with to this day, if they had that same feeling.
And that feeling, by the way, is a feeling that some of the insurrectionists claimed is in line with their military service. Larry Rendell Brock Jr., the Air Force veteran with the zip ties on the Senate floor, he ended a Facebook post denying the legitimacy of the Biden administration with, quote, against all enemies, foreign and domestic. That's language from the Oath of Enlistment. Army veteran Jerry Green says since January 6th, active duty members have reached out to him with concerns about some of their fellow service members.
And, you know, some of them tell me, yeah, you know, I don't know who I'm looking at now. I don't know who I'm talking to now. I don't know if I have a problem about race or something that someone said to me. I don't know if I can take it to him or her because I don't really know how they feel.
That's Jerry Green, an Army Special Operations veteran and now director of outreach with Vote Vets, talking about experiences he had decades ago encountering racism and far-right extremism in the military. Well, let's turn now to retired U.S. Army Colonel Jeff McCausland. He served in the Army for 30 years. He's now a CBS Radio national security consultant and visiting professor of international security at Dickinson College. Colonel McCausland, welcome to the program.
Megan, it's a great pleasure to be with you.
So I'd like us to be able to have this conversation, first of all, with the appropriate context in mind. The United States military is vast. Its ranks are full of extremely hardworking Americans who are giving their lives in service. So how would you describe the depth of the problem of right-wing extremism in the military?
Well, as you said at the top, Magna, we have these disturbing surveys done by Military Times that not only show about a third of all people serving have encountered some evidence of white supremacism or right-wing nationalism in the ranks, but at the same time, that is growing as a significant jump over the last couple of years. And frankly, what worries me the most in all this, I don't think we got our arms around yet how deep the problem is. And the problem varies. You know, you mentioned at the top about 1 out of 5 of the people so far arrested had some kind of military connection, but they really kind of fall out into four groups. One of those who just served in enlistment and got out and went back to their communities and joined one of these groups, or perhaps were in the group prior to that. There are those like Mr. Brock you talked about who are worrisome because they're a career officer like me, retired, and now involved in this. He could, in fact, under the law, be brought back in the uniform and court-martialed under the UCMJ. There were a couple of people who were actually active duty people. There was a captain from Fort Bragg. That disturbs me as a retired officer a great deal because she happens to be a lady, is in the ranks. She will be court-martialed. And then there are folks who are in the National Guard and Reserves that were participated And in terms of how they're dealt with, that's a bit more complicated. But we have to look at that kaleidoscope of who these people were, and I think getting the problem of how we deal with it. But so far, I don't think we've got our arms around how big the problem is across the military, because for the last several years, the Trump administration has focused its attention and everything it's talked about in terms of a terrorism strategy about left-wing nationalism, about the threat by so-called Islamic terrorists or groups like Antifa or Black Lives Matter. And that's where their strategy has went, and that's where the money to monitor these things has gone.
Yeah. Well, so Colonel McCausland, on that point, there are many folks who say that the U.S. military is a reflection of the country that it serves, the country that it represents. And if there's a growing problem of right-wing extremism in the military, it's because there's a growing problem across the country. I mean, for example, not that long ago, we spoke with former Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel about extreme ideologies in military ranks. And here's what he told us.
Our military, these great men and women who dedicate their lives to our country, the security of our country, are no different in one way than all Americans. They look to their leaders for direction. And when you have leaders trying to politicize every element of our government, of everything, including dismantling our civil service process and our civil service system, to take politics out of government career, government employees, the military will not be untouched by that.
Colonel McCausland, you want to respond to that?
I totally agree with Secretary Hagel. There's no two ways about it. And across the history of the military for the last couple hundred years, we've seen that ebb and flow in American society and an ebb and flow in the military, probably harkening back to right after the American Civil War with the rise of the Ku Klux Klan. And, you know, in the 1990s, we saw a resurrection of this in the aftermath of events in society like Ruby Ridge, the attack on Ruby Ridge, the Waco incident down in Texas. And that manifested itself in the most terrible domestic terrorism attack in the 20th century, which was by Timothy McVeigh, a disgruntled soldier, a loner, in the bombing of the Morro building, which killed about 160 people. We saw that drop off after 9/11 as the nation focuses attention on the threat from abroad. But in 2008, 2009, you know, the Homeland Security published a report that said, you know, the election of the first African-American president, a severe economic downturn in the United States, and more soldiers returning, particularly from service in Iraq and Afghanistan, and finding it difficult to reintegrate into society, was a breeding ground for right-wing nationalism within the force as well as society more broadly. That particular study raised a firestorm on Capitol Hill amongst conservatives. So, in fact, the Obama administration actually quashed it. And in the last decade, of course, we've seen these groups grow and them reflected again in those in the ranks.
So for those who bother to who care to pay attention, there's been evidence for, I mean, we're talking across decades now, of a particular problem in the military. So from current and former members of the military amongst the On Point listenership on this issue, here's OJ, who left us this message recommending that military leaders look for signs of extremism early, particularly during the recruitment process.
I'm a 20-year vet of the U.S. Navy, and it ran rapid when I was in. I was talking about the subject of the nationalism and the radicalization. I think the one thing they could just ask them right from the start when they're joining, do you have these views? Because a lot of them, they don't seem ashamed of it and proud to say it. Just ask.
I'm joined today by Colonel Jeff McCausland. He's a retired U.S. Army colonel, served for 30 years, commanded a battalion in combat during the Gulf War in 1990 and 91. He's now a visiting professor of international security at Dickinson College and author of Battle Tested, Gettysburg Leadership Lessons for 21st Century Leaders. And Colonel McCausland, I guess we're going to jump for a second here to potential solutions, but I just wanted to hear you respond to what OJ said about whether or more can be done during the enlistment process to root out potential extremism.
Well, certainly there can, Magna, but this becomes a logistical problem and an economic problem. On the one hand, the U.S. military competes for the best and the brightest in American society to the ranks, and because we're an enlisted force, competes with industry. So when the economy in the United States is doing well, we find enlistment becomes very tough. And at the onset of the Trump administration, military was finding it tough to meet its goals. So you got that to consider. And if you lined up 10, 18-year-olds right now, Only three of them would qualify to join the military based on their physical fitness, their education levels, brushes with the law. So it's a very competitive environment for youngsters to join the military. And then secondly, logistically, it's done by recruiters in our villages, towns, and communities all across the United States. And their primary measure of success is, do they meet a certain quota, a number of enlistments across a period of time? So inserting one additional disqualifying factor, participation in a group like this, just makes their job a little bit harder. And you're going to also have to, I think, devote more resources to screening recruits. Do we look at their social media? Do we do more than a simple background check that is done now to screen them prior to advance? And also realize it's going to make recruiting just that much harder on the front end as we screen folks coming in. But we also have to screen folks while they're in the military, because some pick up these particular affiliations after they've joined.
According to police, Dedman, with two teenage girls as his passengers, drove to a local McDonald's meeting up with the rest of the group. There, according to witnesses interviewed by police, he said, "I ran that nigger over."
He was not remorseful. He was laughing. Laughing about the killing.
The victim's death was caused as a result of being struck and run over by the defendant's vehicle.
54-year-old Dean Capsalis of Hudson appeared in court today on Zoom from jail. He's now charged with murder for the road rage hit and run that killed Henry Tapia last week in Belmont. The Middlesex District Attorney's Office announced the upgraded charges today. Witnesses say the two men had pulled over, gotten out, and argued. But it wasn't just witnesses who heard the angry dispute, during which Capsalis allegedly used a racial slur.
There was a Ring doorbell near the scene of this incident, and it captured the audio of the interaction between the victim and the defendant. The defendant can be heard calling the victim a series of derogatory terms.
Seconds later, prosecutors say Capsalis got back in his truck and allegedly turned it into a weapon. He was arraigned last week on charges including a civil rights violation causing injury.
The witnesses watched as the defendant accelerated his truck and drove it straight towards the victim, striking him with the front of his vehicle.
Capsalis took off. He would later turn himself in. A makeshift memorial now marks the scene. Today, this man kneeled down to pay his respects to a father of three who was called a racial slur, then run over and left for dead.
He said that he couldn't breathe and that he was going to die.
And within the past half hour, a neighbor here came out to light the candles here at the scene. Dean Capsalis turned himself in a short time after the incident, waiving his Miranda rights and telling Belmont police that Henry Tapia had threatened him. But prosecutors say there's no independent evidence to corroborate that claim. Reporting live in Belmont, Todd Keskevich, WCVB News Center 5.
This the city of Chicago.
Chicago's Bucket Boys. They're a local institution with their 5-gallon buckets and drumsticks. Hundreds of these street performers drum on corners for tips, but the young black male musicians sometimes face opposition to their music from downtown residents. WBEZ's Natalie Moore has the story about the latest complaint and a warning. This story contains a racial slur.
It started with Twitter. Writer and teacher Aurelius Raines scrolled through recently. One post from a Chicagoan denouncing a sign in Streeterville caught his eye. The post included a picture of the sign. It said, "Do you dislike hearing bucket banger noise in your home? Help your neighbors. Call 911 and report." His friend, poet Tara Betts, saw it too.
I was really surprised how many people responded to the singular tweet of me saying we should just tear them down. So I was like, and then I started texting Aurelius like, "Did you see this?"
Every once in a while, we just become two old 40-ish old people. We just go out and do things randomly. And we thought this would be a great thing for us to go do randomly.
Raines ended up going by himself last weekend. No Bucket Boys in sight. He saw three flyers taped to lamppost. He threw two away and put one in his back pocket. He recorded himself.
I'm on Michigan and Pearson over by Water Tower Place, downtown Chicago. And I just want to draw your attention to this foolishness right here. This is not okay. What I urge, I respect people's right to be annoyed by street musicians. I'm telling you that this right here It's just violence against black people.
The Bucket Boys originated from the Robert Taylor homes back in the 1990s. They can be seen at the intersections along the Dan Ryan, near the Art Institute, and numerous other spots around Chicago. A continual new generation of youth bringing vibrancy to a big city. Not everyone appreciates the drumming. Over the years, downtown buildings have circulated petitions to stop them. The signs up in Streeterville don't have a name attached. The Area Neighborhood Association says they don't know who's behind the flyers. Mercy Carmichael manages a group of performers who call themselves Chicago Bucket Boys.
If I got outraged every time white America treated Bucket Boys like niggas, I'd be mad all the time. So I try not to over-emotionalize things.
Getting the police called on them is normal.
They're not arrested all the time, but they are fined. They're given tickets, which is a financial prison in itself.
Even if they have a permit.
Personally, I manage a small group of the boys, right? And we've been around the world. Mexico City, Mexico, Nigeria, everywhere I go is pretty okay, except here.
The Bucket Boys are as much a part of the city as summertime taste of Chicago. The drummers aren't formally trained, but exude creativity and hustle with their rhythmic flourishes and spinning sticks. Betts, the poet, is also founder of the Worldwind Center, an arts nonprofit. To her, the anti-Bucket Boys flyer stirs up something else for her about Black forms of music and those Black people playing in public space.
It kept bringing me back to this idea of how sound or noise is racialized, right? Like when I think about what happened on U Street with the cellular phone store that was playing go-go music and the new neighbors were starting to complain. DC, DA, or if we go and look at what started to happen with gentrification in Harlem, and people started to complain about the drummers in Marcus Garvey Park on Saturdays who had been drumming there for over 20 years. You know, all of a sudden, it's too noisy. It's too disruptive. You know, these things that have been a part of the community long before some of the new residents have moved in suddenly become problematic, and you have to ask why.
That why in Chicago? Even after last summer's racial reckoning of racism and police violence, someone would post a sign telling people to call the police on a group of Black boys because their drumming is considered a nuisance. Natalie Moore, WBEZ News.
In the mid-1950s, and if you know the story of the case and such, it was very unlikely that those men were going to be convicted. Of course, it's interesting. One thing comment I'll make is that, in a way, they've been convicted by history, partly through the actions of Emmett Till's mother, who, you know, this is an infamous thing or famous thing, is that, you know, she insisted that her son's coffin be open at the funeral. And a photograph was taken of Emmett Till and how his horrifically mutilated face, which appeared in Jet magazine. And that's an iconic image that many of us know. It's a horrifying image. And she insisted that it be so that the whole world could see what had happened to her son. So in a certain way, yes, those white men were acquitted, but they were convicted, really. And she made sure that they were. And that, in a way, that's the legacy of that case to this very day, I think.
The Chicago City Council voted this week to designate the childhood home of Emmett Till a city landmark. The teenager's murder in Mississippi was a tragic and seminal moment in the civil rights movement in the 1950s. From member station WBEZ in Chicago, Claudia Morrell reports.
Emmett Till lived with his mom in a nondescript red brick two-flat home in Chicago's Woodlawn neighborhood on the south side. In the summer of 1955, he took a train down to Mississippi to visit his uncle. And for 2 weeks, he spent his days picking cotton with his cousin. But one morning, two armed white men kidnapped Till, one falsely claiming that the 14-year-old had whistled at his wife. 3 days would pass before Till's body was found. His brutal murder was a catalyst for the civil rights movement.
And so before there was Trayvon Martin, before there was Eric Garner, there was Emmett Till.
That's Alderman Jeanette Taylor speaking just after the city council here voted to make the house a landmark.
We still have a real problem in this country not addressing the brutality that has happened to Black folks, but also making sure we apologize and recognize it. We will repeat history if we don't address it. These are the hard conversations that we're not willing to have, which is why in this country we can't move forward.
Naomi Davis is a local artist and neighborhood activist who helped lead the effort to designate the house. She says the brutality of Till's murder overshadows what she thinks is another significant part of the Emmett Till story, the Great Migration, the movement of millions of Black men and women who fled the Jim Crow South to northern cities.
We don't make a lot of the brilliance of Black people and the need for a true and new narrative about Blackness. That we built cities. I mean, we came here and points east and points west and created an economic boom wherever we landed.
The house is located west of Jackson Park, where the Barack Obama Presidential Library will soon be located. Naomi Davis is working with the city to repair the house and transform it into a museum and cultural center. For NPR News, I'm Claudia Morell in Chicago.
I was asked to do a show that dealt with the emerging African nations. And at that time, I was wearing my hair, as I am now, straightened. And I wasn't comfortable in the woman's skin with that style of hair because I knew they didn't wear their hair straightened in Africa. And so I went through rehearsal with the straightened hair. But the night before the show, which was being done live, I went to a barbershop in Harlem called the Shalimar, where Duke Ellington used to have his hair cut. And I walked in, and I was greeted by a gentleman who was a barber, and his name was Streamline. I told him I wanted him to cut my hair very short and then shampoo it so that it would go back to its natural state. And so he sat me in the chair, and he proceeded to cut, and he cut it kind of short up to crop. And I said, that's not it. I want you to cut it as close to my scalp as possible. And then I want you to shampoo it so it goes back to its natural state. He went and sat down. When he had regained he came to me and he said, are you sure that's what you want? I said, yes. So the show was being done live. Okay. The next morning, I go to the studio. I have my hair wrapped in a scarf. I go to makeup and costume. And then when the director said, places, I took the scarf off. You could hear a hair hit the floor. So finally, he walked up to me and he said, Cicely, you cut your hair. And I sheepishly held my head and I shook my head, yes. So he said, you know, I wanted to ask you to do that, but I didn't have the nerve. And then it was George Scott who asked my agent to send me in to meet with them for East Side, West Side. I said, well, what do I do about my hair? They said, your hair, leave it that way. And that is what created the natural hair craze, that show, and my wearing it that way on that show. Because I got letters from hairdressers all over the country telling me that I was affecting their business because their clients were having their hair cut off so they could wear it like the girl on television. The cornrow and Sounder. You know, I knew during that period that women in the South cornrowed their head. So I said that Rebecca would wear her hair in that manner. But every time I changed the hairdo, it had not to do with me. It had to do with authenticating the character that I was playing.
The pioneering African-American actress Cicely Tyson has died at the age of 96. She started her career as a model but went on to become a star of film and TV. Barack Obama said she'd left a mark on the world that few would match. Our arts correspondent Vincent Dowd looks back at her life.
Cicely Tyson was born poor in Harlem, New York, to West Indian parents. Her looks brought modelling work and soon acting roles on TV and in films.
Jesus, will you come by here?
But in 1972, it was the film Sounder, set in Depression-era Louisiana, which made Tyson a star. She took a Golden Globe as Best Actress and an Oscar nomination.
Good morning, Rebecca.
I come see Nathan.
Ain't no business except Sunday and holidays.
You mean tell me I can't see my own husband?
2 years later, she took an Emmy for the autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman on TV, a chronicle of an American life from slavery to civil rights. She played Coretta Scott King in a miniseries. She felt she had a part to play addressing discrimination.
I realize there were a number of issues I had to address. I was not one to wave a placard or march up and down the street and yell and scream. And I chose my career as my platform.
In the 80s, Tyson was married to jazz musician Miles Davis. She became a cultural figurehead for Black America and was invited to speak at services for Aretha Franklin and Maya Angelou. In 2018, there was an honorary Academy Award described as for the performances and personal integrity which inspired filmmakers, actors and audiences.
This is the culmination of all those years of have and have not. God bless you all. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Cicely Tyson, who has died at the age of 96.
And finally today, we want to take a few minutes to remember Cicely Tyson. The legendary actress died on Thursday at the age of 96. I had the pleasure of interviewing her just last week about her new memoir, Just As I Am. We think it's one of her final conversations. So we thought one way to remember Miss Tyson would be to share more of that conversation, like this exchange when she told me how she more or less fell into acting and modeling while she was working in the typing pool at the Red Cross.
Yes, I was walking up Fifth Avenue. I would spend my time, my lunch hour, actually, at Lord & Taylor. That was my favorite store. And I would go there every time I finished my lunch and peruse what they had. I loved that store. And someone tapped me on the shoulder and asked for my agency. And I asked, what agency? They said, aren't you a model? I said, no. And they said, well, you should be. And I said, well, how do you do that? They said, well, you register at a modeling school, and then you get your certificate if you're good enough. And then I started distributing my photographs among the agencies, and then I began to get calls, and that's how it started.
And one of the things that stands out for me in reading the book is that when you set your mind something, you not only set out to do it, you set out to learn everything you can about it. I mean, you took a class, you took acting classes.
No question, mm-hmm. No question, no question. That's the way I am about everything. It doesn't matter how minuscule it seems. I want to know. Someone said to me, why do you feel you have to start at the bottom? I said, because that's where the seed is. You know, how do I know what to do and how to do it if I don't find out what the seed of it is? And so I have to go into the seed to understand what the root gives.
Those efforts would grow into a career spanning decades, bringing us iconic roles in Sounder, Roots, and the autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman, among many others. And despite her unlikely beginnings, Miss Tyson said she felt that acting was her life's calling, even when it caused a rift with her mother. As she explains here, when I asked her to give young artists advice.
Well, I don't feel like I am one to give advice, except to say, you know, my mother did not want me to be an actress. And she said I could not live in her house and do that. But in my gut, I knew there was something there that I was put here to do. And so I moved out and into the apartment of a girlfriend who had an apartment or job wore the same size dress I wore, et cetera, et cetera. And she didn't speak to me for a couple of years. And although I lived long enough, and she lived long enough to see that I was not going to live in a den of iniquity, and that I would not forget the teaching that she gave me in my early years. And finally she came around, and I was able to hear her say, "I am so proud of you," and see that I was not going to forget my beginnings.
And so your advice would be what? Just stick with it and...
Just stick with it. Just stick with it. There's a reason why. There's always a reason why you keep going in the direction you chose to go in.
That was actress Cicely Tyson from unaired portions of our conversation last week. She died on Thursday at the age of 96.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, January 30, 2021. So I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, observations, counter-racist suggestions. The number is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Many things to share before we get started. This week, reminded me very much of this exact time last year, January 2020. In fact, they were talking at the beginning of the week, they were saying, "Man, Kobe Bryant, can you believe it's been a year since Kobe Bryant died? And it doesn't seem like a year, and my goodness, and blah blah blah, all the things that have happened since then, and the Rona and everything else, and other people that have died through all types of, you know, illness, sickness, white supremacy." And then for just within the last 10 days, really, not even that much, Henry Aaron, Cicely Tyson, journalist Sekou Smith, black male journalist, and John Chaney. Most of these black people, victims of racism, used their time, energy, talents to address the problem, the system of white supremacy. So very much reminded me of this time last year and kind of an ominous beginning to a so-called new year. I said, wow, this does not seem like a new year at all. It feels very familiar, unfortunately. But hopefully we will maintain, stick to it, and just keep working on the problem. As I think Dr. Welsing said, be not discouraged. Be not discouraged, but was not a pleasant week. Number one, I played the audio segment they were talking about in 2011, 10 years. Daryl Dedman, a convicted murderer, suspected or not suspected, race soldier, not a suspect at all, race soldier, Daryl Dedman, he killed James Craig Anderson in 2011. He hopped in the vehicle in Mississippi. He had the two white women in the vehicle with him and ran over James Craig Anderson. They had attacked him first, and then they ran over and killed him and bragged about it. I played that segment. We heard about Henry Tapia, black male. This is in Massachusetts, not Mississippi, deep south, but Massachusetts, where they had a so-called road rage incident. And this suspected race soldier, Dean Capsulis, I think this could be someone who's accepted as classified as white, but he's in custody, where apparently they were on the road, had some sort of dispute. The victim, Mr. Tapia, black male, he exited the vehicle, and then this white male attacked him verbally, ran him over and killed him with the vehicle, and, you know, sped off. I have repeated throughout the past year or so, no verbal confrontations. We've had a number of folks. I think Irie, she shared the report about, I think she said she was in her vehicle. She saw a white man and a white woman. They were gunning the accelerator, mashing down on the accelerator repeatedly, even though they were stopped. I think they were at an intersection or a stoplight. And it's a black mom pushing her small child in the stroller. And they're gunning the accelerator, laughing as though, hey, it'd be fine. We could run this Negro woman over. Her and her child. Run them over. Right? And so she's watching all this. They allow this black mother to leave after they, you know, molested her somewhat with her children. They take off and then they end up harassing Irie. And I said, you know, seems like there's a lot of that has been. Daryl Dedman, that was, you know, 10 years ago. This is white people do this sort of thing. Racists do this sort of thing. So, hey, if you're out on the road, no confrontations. In fact, distance. Once it seems that they're, you know, this white person is trying to do this and trying to do that or what have you, if you can't slow down and just allow them to go on down the road, I would find the biggest, most well-lit, highly populated area that you can find and immediately. And you can even call security. You could be calling security, find a super populated area, sprint, ask for help. Immediately go someplace that you feel that you can safely get assistance. I think the most important thing being either you can be dialing if you have your phone with you, or go someplace that's super populated. Lots of people will have all kinds of iPhones and such, so you can get assistance. But distance is the big thing. Not engaging anyone in this type of situation, not verbally. Don't even say anything to them. Just get their information. If you need to get, you know, if you can take a picture, what have you, get their license plate and slow it down. Let them go on down the road so you can make your report. But minimizing contact, you do not want to engage. You have no idea if they have a firearm with them, if they have other whites, maybe they're in a different vehicle. You just have no idea. If you did not prepare to engage in some sort of mortal combat, distance. James Craig Anderson. I had not thought about that case in some years. 2011 is a long time. Let's see. Cicely Tyson. I would have played the late Pamela Evans Harris. One of the many, many times that she was a guest on the program, we talked about Cicely Tyson and Pamela Evans Harris. She talked about how Miss Tyson, she exhibited black self-respect by which roles she took, which roles she declined. And I'm not going to be out here just, you know, taking any type of role for you to portray black people as savages and ignorant. And, you know, I'm not going to be in the Fox, the O.J. Simpson story. I'm not going to be in that one. So I can just talk about what a no count brute and a savage that he is. And she, Pam, I'm talking about, talked about how that had such an impact on her. And she appreciated the films that she was in. You heard a number of them, the autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman and the Rosa Parks story. I don't even think they mentioned that one. But she, I mean, 70 years. I, for a long time, have discussed the importance, if we're talking about a writer, entertainer, whatever it is, look at their total body of work. That can help you in evaluating one individual piece or in terms of looking for greater themes in what they are trying to convey with their products. And Cicely Tyson has an enormous body of work. Like, if I'm thinking like, hey, context of white supremacy, we've been on the air for 12 years. Like, wow, 70 years of work. Most of it, as I said, pretty constructive. Roots, the story, the Rosa Parks story, Sounder, most of it, I should say, dealing with racism, white supremacy in some way, shape, form. Anyway, that is in the archives where Pam talked about that. And I can even add, I snickered because she was saying that, which was brilliant. People have heard Pam. She was giving her brilliant assessment. And I said, well, she was in the Help, which is true. But that does not take away from, you know, but she was in the Help. Anywho, John Chaney also passed away this week as well. For people who are not familiar, a longtime basketball coach at Temple University, HBCU, unless I'm mistaken, in the Philadelphia area, where he took the program. They had lots of success. I think the most success that the program had is during his tenure there, and so much of his tenure was about trying to, as I said, most of these people that passed away over the last 10 days or so, just like Mr. Aaron, just like Miss Cicely Tyson, used their talents in some way, generally very directly, to address racism, white supremacy. I posted, there have been tons of reports about all of these folks, really, but John Chaney specifically, and they were talking about his efforts, how he worked so consistently to help black people. So I just wanted to read a little bit from the report. This is at the New York Times about John Chaney. They say his raspy, Chaney's raspy voice, dark under-eye circles, and perpetually loosened tie projected the image of someone who'd endured a long day at the office. And typically he had his practices ritually began at 5:30 in the morning. His appearance also served as an apt reminder of his role as a fierce advocate for black opportunity, jobs for coaches, and education for players who grew up poor. His death comes just months after that of John Thompson Jr., the former Georgetown coach with whom Chaney teamed to protest NCAA regulations that made freshmen ineligible if they did not meet academic requirements, and later made them pay their own way the first year. Basketball coaches who recruited players from inner cities in the late 1980s knew it would close off doors to a college education metaphor. Thompson, a bear of a man. That's another metaphor. And that one just like the man, not always. Anyway, John Thompson, a bear of a man who could use his 6'10" frame to send a message, famously walked off the court before a game to protest. Chaney used his words. He called the regulations a racist rule enacted by racist presidents. I think I said direct. Mr. Chaney was not known for pussyfooting. I think he had a reputation for being pretty direct in addressing racism, white supremacy, and striving to help black players, black people in general. But he passed away just this week as well. Rough week. Generally, they all are under the system of white supremacy, racism. But I guess if anything, folks can take some time if you are not familiar with these folks to maybe get more familiar with them. Maybe if you live in Pennsylvania, you should definitely know about Mr. Chaney. Same thing if you live in the Georgia area, you should know about Mr. Aaron, or even Alabama. That's where he was. I think where he was born, Mr. Aaron. So should know about these folks and what they did to try to solve the problem. Continuing, we started the segment on the school system in Canada. I thought that was important just for a different perspective, kind of the same motivation behind the Global Sunday Talk that we have. We can hear different perspectives. So to hear from a totally different location how they're addressing the COVID situation, specifically with schooling, and hearing some of the same problems that it has not been as well coordinated in some areas as they would like it to be, and trying to find what they call balance, safety, and then being able to get people back to school. I thought that segment was important also because they talked about the mental health component for children And I think that's hugely important. I think we talked about that yesterday on the Neutralizing Workplace Racism segment. And if there are younger people out there, if you are in school or if they're parents and you know younger people who are in school and they would like to share with other younger folks, I think from yesterday we heard at least we have a few folks who would be interested in kind of talking about what this past year has been like, having to be online, being away from in-person contact with their friends, or I don't know if we have some athletic folks who have, if this has impacted, maybe they're on the volleyball team or the basketball team or whatever it is. So, you know, it has disrupted their ability to engage in athletics or whatever else. I think that's important because I think lots of folks have talked about how stressful this past year has been for a variety of reasons, but to kind of be mindful of how much of an impact it's had on children and what they've missed and the stress levels. I think I've heard a few reports about increased levels of suicide and other health problems that younger people are manifesting because of all of this. So I thought that was important for a number of reasons, just to kind of get a different, at least geographically, a different perspective on you know, some of the differences, some of the similarities on how this is impacting the school situation with the Rona. Let's see. Next. We heard reading is more important than watching television. Reading more important than watching television. And we have our book club. We are currently, we are about 75% of the way done with Jeffrey Toobin's The Run of His Life. It has been so informative, even though I think this book should contest for one of the worst books that we've read just because of the amount of deception in the work. But we, I think at least for myself and others, I know we've had a number of folks, listeners, who said they have changed their opinion, that they, like Gusty, originally thought, oh yeah, Orenthal James hacked up all these white people, you know, disgraceful. And just from reading Toobin's book, which is super biased that O.J. Simpson is a no count, you know, Negro killer. Just from reading this book, it has changed a lot of our opinions and made us, I think, much more knowledgeable about the Simpson case. I've said attempted counter-racists should be quasi-O.J. Simpson experts. You can learn so much about racism, white supremacy, affirmative action. You can learn lots about lots of things. Reading is so much more important than watching television. And this is a great illustration of why, because so much of the, really all of the television content around the O.J. Simpson case is white supremacy propaganda. You will just be even more confused and deceived and duped if you sit around and watch the FX series and the ESPN documentary, which is disgraceful to even have to call that a documentary. I think Red in Ohio asked that question. She said they have genres that are called true crime. So if the information in the book is not accurate, should it lose the label true crime? I would ask the same question if a documentary film, or at least a film branding itself a documentary, has flagrantly false information that can be easily disproven. Does it begin at what point, like how much false information does it have to have before it loses the designation documentary that this is propaganda? This is not even attempting to stick with the facts. Reading more important than watching television. Now, I say all of that, I would not exactly say I have enjoyed Jeffrey Toobin's book. Like, I wouldn't say, oh, this is awesome reading and it's just great. I'm going to look to get more of Toobin's work. Not at all. And he was masturbating on Zoom. Can't forget, that's the whole reason we read this in the first place. Isabel Wilkerson's case, The Origins of Our Discontent, discontents, plural, is also a book I did not enjoy. I think many of our listeners said that they did not enjoy. In fact, they thought it was dangerous, deliberately deceptive. That's two books in a row we read in the book club, deliberately deceptive. Isabel Wilkerson put on her Facebook page. I'm just looking at the languaging around all this. She said, one final jaw-dropping announcement to close out the year! Exclamation point. Cased, The Origins of Our Discontents has been named the number one book of 2020 across all genres by the definitive database for the publishing world, based on a tabulation of all major publications, awards, and nominations. Publishers Marketplace released its final very best of the best books of 2020, declaring Cased the book of the year from start to finish. Cased is the first nonfiction book to achieve this designation, these industry experts noted. That is a lot of white validation and, like, wow, the very best of the best. It's not even just the best book. I read all of that and I said, and that in conjunction, we've had a book club on the cows for 2011, 10 years. I mean, now again, Cicely Tyson, calm down. But we have had a book club for a decade. We have not, to my knowledge, had anyone, any author gripe, yell at us, you know, take that down. I am disgusted, you know, that you all are reading my book or talking bad about, you know, my book. We've never had that except Isabel Wilkerson. And we read two of her books. This didn't happen when we read The Warmth of Other Suns. I glowed about that book. I shouldn't say that. I celebrated that book, top 10, so informative, and it is very informative. It's not like Cased at all, but it has so much information. Did not hear a peep from Isabel Wilkerson, but with Cased, violating copyright regulations, this will not be tolerated. We will take all appropriate action. Must be removed immediately. Never had that happen in the 10-year history of the Cows Book Club. That, in conjunction with her written report about the very best of the best books of 2020, above and beyond anything according to all the experts and all the publishing data, I read this and said, geez, if it was not for all of the misspellings and name calling in Nutricide, this would be the worst book I've ever read. Not the worst book of 2020, the worst book I've ever read, which is slated to be made into a film. I don't know if they'll call it a documentary or true crime or what title. She is a victim of white supremacy, cowbell. We talked about all of that. She said what she said in the book. We talked about it in detail in the book study, which is still available. But wow, I can only reiterate, white people do publish books to confuse non-white people about racism, white supremacy. Apparently, that is a very important activity. Have to use your brain computer and look for logic, metaphor, when reading, really when processing, evaluating information. Even if it's a non-white author, a black author, use logic. White people publish lots of books about racism to confuse victims of white supremacy. We've been here, well, the book club has been here for a decade, but the cows, I guess in a couple days, it'll be 12 years of attempted counter-racist radio. Hopefully we've helped non-white people, victims of racism, get a more accurate understanding of what racism, white supremacy is, how it works. Invest if you think the cows has been constructive. racism-notes.blogspot.com racism-notes.blogspot.com. You will see my review of Isabel Wilkerson's Cased. It is the top post on my blog for the time being. Share, read, touches on many of the points that we talked about and were illustrated in our book study of Cased, but that is the top post on my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. PayPal button is in the top right corner. We're also on Cash App, cash.app/$thecows. Enormous gratitude to all of the investors who have supported us 12 years. Hopefully we have helped some victims of racism get some suggestions, things that they can do to help us solve this problem as soon as possible. You can also invest. Wishlist is at Amazon.com under Gus T. Renegade. Much obliged to all the folks who have nabbed items. I hope the cows has been worthy of your time and energy. Let's see. Speaking of reading, one of the reports that we heard, they mentioned, or they didn't mention, they spoke with Andre Perry. He was a guest on the program this past spring. He had one of the better quotes of last year. There's nothing wrong with black people that ending racism won't fix. He was a guest on the program in the spring. He was in the segment. They were talking about the Rona and some of the efforts of the Biden administration to address racism. Is it going to be sufficient? What's the metaphor? Don't hold your breath. They spoke to, or a different report, they were talking about the military and police involvement in the Capitol terrorism, treason. We've talked about that quite a bit. Even had a guest this week on the program discussing that. They mentioned, and here in Seattle, they had, you know, a number of big reports. They have said repeatedly the largest contingent of officers in D.C., police officers, that is, from one specific police department, the Seattle Police Department. Seattle is 3,000 miles from Washington, D.C. Like, it basically, to fly, even if you get a direct flight, it basically takes the whole day to fly to D.C. Like, when we went to do the retreat this summer, flight left at 8 a.m. that morning. We touched down in D.C. a little before 5 p.m. Like, it's, the whole day is gone. Like, to get, you have to be there the day before and plan this out and... It's not a just, oh, wake up and decide, oh, go hang out in D.C. for a little while. 3,000 miles to go engage in treasonous activity. Making me look bad for saying Seattle is the best plantation in the known universe. Let's see. They had one more or several more, but I'll stop there. Just to make sure we can go ahead and get to folks who dialed in. If you can take about 5 minutes to share your thoughts, observations, comments, that would be great. Make sure everyone gets at least one chance to speak. If you know you are in a noisy environment, if you could use your mute button, that would be super appreciated. Just makes it much better, much more efficient. If we do not have to compete with loud noises, the television, other people, whatever it is, just unmute. If you can get to a quieter area so that you can speak, and then mute your line. And then if you have additional comments, just unmute and rejoin us. Much obliged. For this broadcast specifically, we're supposed to be mindful of words. Did you hear how many times the word context was used this week? Like, generally on the compensatory call-in, it'll be at least one report context. This week, context, like... Excellent job picking a name for a program. But for this broadcast, if we could not use metaphors, race soldiers are very deceptive with words. Was it the late John Thompson is a bear of a man? Arr, the man not. They are very deceptive with metaphors. And generally, the metaphors support white supremacy, racism. Sometimes very directly, we were talking about a dark day and all that. Earlier this week, other times it'll be more subtle, bear of a man. If we could be specific, precise, exact with the words that we choose, that would be super appreciated. I will prompt about the metaphors. Thank you for being mindful with our vernacular for this broadcast. The number again is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. For our NAB first few folks, we had Professor, was it Perry, Dre on the program. Philip Dre was on the program this past Tuesday. White Man Suspected Racist. We were talking about his book, At the Hands of Persons Unknown. I thought it was so just timely. They just declared in Chicago, Emmett Till's residence is going to be a landmark. And he was just here. We were talking about that case. Jeff Toobin is going to talk about that case at the end of the book. But we were talking about that case, and he said that the white killers were convicted. That right there has to be a metaphor, because they were acquitted. So it would have to be. And I think he was saying that history has convicted them. And I think many of us, read in Ohio myself, are just kind of, what exactly do you mean? These race soldiers, murderers, bragged about killing this black child and were paid to brag and recount how they killed and castrated this black child. What do you mean they were convicted? Anyway, conviction or no. Now, Emmett Till's house is a historical landmark and will be close to the Obama Library, if that means anything to, you know, folks in the Chicago area. Maybe that'll be a reason to go and visit. You can go in and check out those landmarks and where Cabrini Green used to be. 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Long live the memory of Harold Washington. *61, first few folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hey, I'm going to go back to, I guess, the Capitol a few weeks ago. What I find really interesting is how the FBI went out of their way. You know, they put white folks in jail, you know, for going into the Capitol. You know, they looked at the videos, and they really went out of their way to put these whites in jail, you know, like the policemen and firefighters, you know, when they went to the airports to find, I guess, tickets or hotels. But what I really find truly interesting is that when the FBI sees black people on, you know, on videos getting killed in the street and brutalized and murdered, they do nothing about it. They don't put cops in jail who kill black people, you know, like we see, like Tamir Rice, Eric Garner, the guy in Wisconsin that got shot in the back a few times for just walking away. But they say, oh, you know, we're looking for civil rights violations. I just find that interesting how they see videos of blacks being murdered and do nothing, but they want to put they don't put the whites in jail for killing blacks, or, you know, but they want to go after white people for walking into a Capitol. And the other thing that I noticed is the term that they kept using, whites keep using. They said, well, that bothers our democracy. And I don't think we live in a democracy. This is a system of racism and white supremacy, especially as black people. That's what we live under. Maybe white people live under democracy, but black people, we don't live under one. And that's all I had, and I'll mute my line.
Much obliged, sir. Thank you for your commentary. Just to that first point, it's certainly accurate. They do not, white people do not use all of their facial recognition technology and utilize the full extent of all their law enforcement capabilities to arrest and charge white people who have killed black people, whether they're civilians or enforcement officials. They haven't done that with this Capitol situation either. In fact, I know for the police officers in Seattle, they said during the report, none of those officers have been arrested. And they've said that they're talking about not pursuing a lot of these people. It was one report just this week. They said they were discussing not charging a lot of these folks because they said if we aggressively pursue as many of these people as we can, it could clog up the court system. They had a different report because we spoke about this last week. I think someone found at least one black person who was at the January 6th siege. And they said, oh, yeah, he charged. Bang, got him. And we're looking fullest extent of the law. And they were looking at comparisons like, well, wait a minute. Now, if we're going really hard on him, it should be lots of folks where we're doing the same thing. And they're just not seeing that. Like, they're doing a lot of talk, but thus far I've heard lots of excuses and some backpedaling about wanting to be real aggressive in prosecuting and charging everybody who was involved with this. So I've seen the same sort of lax attitude even with this, even though they've got a lot of tough talking rhetoric. We shall see.
Gus, may I say one thing right quick? So you're saying like the, because I saw on TV, you know, the guy that was dressed up like an Indian, so they, none of the whites went to jail for this?
I didn't say none. I'm just saying that they have already started to have reports where, as I said, number one, where they've said, I don't know if we'll be able to prosecute all of these folks aggressively because that could clog the courts. That was one. They've had separate reports saying this black male, Emmanuel Jackson, he has been charged and they're prosecuting him aggressively. That doesn't seem to be the case with as many with all these other white people who actively participated. As I said, the police officers, the Seattle police officers who were there, none of them are charged with anything. I don't even think any of them have been fired thus far. That's what I'm saying, that I have not seen even, you know, a real, I've heard a lot of rhetoric. I've even thus far not seen a lot of aggressive prosecution and arrests, even with these people. That's what I'm saying. I know there have been some, but not, I mean, they could be going to town. It could be paddy wagon. Like, hey, boo, 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 boo. If this was black people, I know what aggressive prosecution looks like.
Oh, okay. Thanks for clearing that up, because, you know, that's what I thought. You know, I'm glad you cleared that up for me, Gus.
Just trying. All still learning. And this is, you know, a still developing situation. If folks have other information, if you have seen where they got the paddy wagons and they're doing no knock warrants and kicking down doors and get out here. We saw you. We got the facial recognition. And you know, if they're doing that, let old Gusty know. But I've not seen any evidence at all. In fact, like I said, I've seen lots of excuses and lots of excuses and reasoning. Oh, maybe we won't be able to prosecute everyone, but we'll see. Let's check in with some of the other folks who dialed in too. Other folks with a hand up. If you have commentary, line should be open. Proceed.
I'll be heard.
Greetings, Rob, in California. Yes, sir.
Greetings, hosts, callers, and listeners. So in Southern California, we have come off of the lockdown. We can now do outside dining, nail shops, barber shops, and things of that nature are open. Still not able to do inside dining. And interestingly enough, the day after the quote-unquote lockdown was rescinded, Southern California had a lot of rain that day. So that kind of that hindered the outside dining. So it's been very interesting to just be in this region while the while the impact of the pandemic is playing out. So the reason that I'm calling in today, I spoke about my issues with my health that I was dealing with previously, before I moved to the state of California. And so when I was assaulted by two people, and that's how I incurred my injury. I was assaulted at the hands of family members, and that's what led me to move into California. And when I was assaulted, I didn't know how injured I was, and I didn't have health insurance, and so I didn't go to the doctor, and the injury healed incorrectly. So now that I'm in California, since I've been here, I've been homeless. I've been working through the homelessness, through my injury, got health insurance, and recently went to the doctor. I had a MRI exam on my cervical and lumbar spine, and I got the results yesterday. And so the initial diagnosis is that I have stenosis of the cervical spine. I guess what that means is, from my understanding, the way that the blood flows through my cervical spine is restricted, and my blood is not flowing properly. I was taken off of work for 1 week. I go back to the doctor on Thursday for further evaluation, because it's not just my cervical spine. In actuality, it's my whole spine. When I initially went to the doctor out here, my primary doctor said, "Oh yeah, Mr. Johnson, I can see that your spine is twisted." And, you know, my response was, "You can see that, like, through my clothing? You know, you don't have to take anything off." She said, "Oh yeah, I can see that right away." And I make that point because people that I've been around, friends and family, would always say to me, "Oh, Rob, I don't see nothing wrong with you. You know, you tripping. You crazy. You doing this to yourself." And those are the type of things that I was hearing from people that I was very close to. And before I left the state of Wisconsin, I went to a neurologist. And the neurologist told me, he said, "Mr. Johnson, you have a brain injury." He said, "The left side of your body is completely different, and don't let anyone tell you anything different." And I'm bringing that up because at this point in time, I don't have an income. My health is deteriorating. I feel a lot of uncertainty. In actuality, I don't know what the future holds for me because of this injury. I spend most of my days trying to realign my body. I have fell into self-medicating myself. I really don't sleep. I may be lucky to sleep 3 or 4 hours at a time through the night. And so if I get heavily intoxicated, I can sleep. So when I go back to the physician this Thursday, I am looking forward to being adequately diagnosed this time. And I would just like to say that for any person that is classified as non-white under this system that we live under, really take health, exercise very seriously. And that's all I have at this time, and I'll mute my line, and I would like to thank everybody for listening. Thank you.
Much obliged, Rob, formerly of Wisconsin. Say that, I mean, wow, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 times. Take your health super seriously in a system of white supremacy. System of white supremacy for lots of non-white people going through all types of things. But for what it is worth, I'm super sorry to hear that you've had to go through all that, like having anything. Once you start having health problems, like you really realize, like, wow, this is one thing we should not take for granted. Just being able to be in your body, like he was saying, just being able to go to sleep without having to, oh my goodness, you know, because of my health problems and I can't rest. I have been there, man. And you talk about that. I remember that. I don't know, folks, the years back when I briefly had back problems and where you're in so much discomfort where you can't even rest. Like, woof, talk about quality of life. Really value your health. And what Rob was saying, when he said he knew he was having these health problems, he knew, you know, there was something wrong with his spine and just his body was not right. He knew that. And he said he had other attempted family members who were saying, oh, it's all in your head. It's nothing wrong with you. There's nothing wrong with your back. You're making this up. Yes, you're fine. You know, you're doing it to yourself. That is in medical apartheid. Harriet A. Washington, we read, that is one of the more poignant moments. It was a black male. I think he was in the California area. He got hurt on the job. A little bit different, wasn't direct racist assault, but basically same thing. He got hurt on the job. He didn't have health insurance. They didn't adequately treat him, and it got worse. And he was, you know, saying, man, like, I, you know, this injury is not correct. Like, it's something wrong with me. And his health deteriorated. And he was telling, I think he was married. He had other attempted family. And he was telling them, like, you know, I don't think this injury, I don't think it healed properly. I think I'm still having problems from this. And they told him the same thing. And in fact, it got so bad. People were saying, you are crazy. You are just a shiftless, lazy nigra, and you don't want to do anything. And I'm laughing, but I mean, it is so not funny. Like, it is so detailed. It's one of the most poignant moments in the book. It goes through all this. And he went through years of suffering and turmoil and going to these racist doctors, the coon man, racist doctors, and tell, oh, you're making it up and it's in your head. You're lazy and rah, 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 and all this. Then they finally figure it out, like, way once it's too late to correct. And he's had all these unnecessary problems. Like, oh, man, he was right. Oh. And so then he dies. And his wife was just like, we told him he was lying all these years. We didn't even believe him when he said he was having all these health. I mean, guilt doesn't even describe, like, she's articulating all this after she's got all the information. I mean, that's classic white supremacy racism. We get all the information about what actually happened and the depth of the white supremacy that's being waged against us, like, way late. But all of this is in Harriet A. Washington, Medical Apartheid, even though we heard about her other book, A Terrible Thing to Waste, Environmental Racism, that was clipped in the audio. Other folks that we have missed completely, much obliged again, Robin, Wisconsin, maintain your health, sir. Other folks that we missed totally.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to the guests. Can I be heard?
Retired firefighter in Florida. Yes, sir.
Yes, Mr. Rob, my thoughts go out to you in your situations, and hope things get better as soon as possible for you. I'll start off by mentioning Ms. Tyson. I would say that she was very prevalent in my surroundings, not personal, of course, but as a significant person that shows a great deal of self-respect on the television, especially during the early to mid-70s. Although she has a huge record of performance in her field, that goes back even back to the 50s, but I recall her vividly in the early to mid 70s, especially the movie Sound. You have to, if you haven't seen it, you have to look at that movie. Great deal of self-respect, not just only her, but also I believe his name was Paul Winfield, who was one of the central people in the movie and the quote-unquote child actor. I can't remember his name at all, but very, very good movie about black family life under the global system of racism, white supremacy during the Depression, and how, and most of her movies were like that, to where she basically participated in forming plans on how to deal with the system of racist white supremacy or solve problems. It's ironic that you played two clips of the president in his inaugural speech in your opening reports. Because that is exactly one of the things that I shared with the young fellows today in the DCS program and what they thought about those two stanzas. I got some interesting commentary. Of course, they didn't necessarily hear it live, but I read it to them because word by word, the inaugural speech is on your phone. I read those two stanzas to them. And from there, I had each of them to stand up and recite on what they thought about what he was saying. Very interesting answers. They were able to be pretty accurate in their understanding of what the president was talking about, and even how on some of it is really is just rhetoric more so than anything. I gave compliments to a couple of the fellows who made good food choices. We do have fruit or fruit juices every session. Our menu is just about anything else is kind of like even more complicated with COVID, 19 and whatnot, as far as being able to get meals, in the way that we were getting before the pandemic. But fruit is available, and I saw some very good choices in the morning period of time where we give them something to snack on. Also, during the film session, I showed them the beginnings of the Black Panther Party. They were, of course, motivated by Malcolm X, who didn't really have a chance to put together whatever ideas that he had. The Black Panther Party was motivated by him. At the end of it, you have questions and answers at the end of that period of time. Let me see what else. There's something else I just forgot for right now. But anyway, I'm on a Zoom program, whereas I was asked to contribute, some understandings on counter racist logic codification. And, the first thought that I had is for everybody to come up with a meaning for the word racism. And some gave their meaning last week, and I'm expecting more coming up tomorrow on a meaning to the word racism. And that's it. Thank you.
That is always a great foundation to lay. What do we mean in terms of definition for racism, white supremacy? So bravo on that. Get good notes, and people might even make some changes, make some edits. And that is always allowed, encouraged to make improvements. And bravo, the young folks getting some produce, some fruits and veggies. Like, that is spectacular. And whoever is, I guess, in charge of the menu, I know that's got to be a big time challenge, doing any sort of meal prep or serving food with, you know, all the craziness of right now. But bravo for the folks making sure that there was some fruit available. And again, just encourage, I guess, if it's attempted parents or if you're educators in any role where you might be working with children, and food is going to be a part of it, like, try as best you can so that it's produce, fruits, veggies, not giving, really think of it this way, setting great food habits that will be a foundation for life. What did Robin Wisconsin just say? Robin California, put a supreme value on your health. So yeah, anybody that's working with younger, really anybody, but especially younger people, and it's going to be food, and you might have, you know, a little bit of sway in the menu, healthy items, water, let's get some water. Everybody can be drinking more water, and then fruits, veggies, no Cheetos. Number again is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Other folks dialed in, if you have a hand up, commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Thomas in New York. Yes, sir.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to the callers. The clip on Canada School. Oh, first, rest in peace to, rest in power to Cicely Tyson, Don Cheney. You know, when I grew up, Gus, there was only a couple of black, still today, it's only a few, but might have been more back then. Head coaches in college, Division I college basketball. He was one of the few. So he always stood out to me. Him and Georgetown coach and Tubby Smith. He was just a very small here, few black coaches, and you know, he did it at a high level. Cicely Tyson, and we lost Hank Aaron so far this year. It's not a good year for us so far. The clip on Canada schools, half the kids in school in one Providence, and schools closed in another, full classrooms in another. They seem to be having the same confusion that we have here in the United States. My kids have only gone back to school once to take the SAT. But other than that, they've been doing total remote learning and
this week that they will be doing that for the rest of the year. And they'll be starting school in the first week of August back in the classroom next year. So, so I don't know. It seems like some states, if their kids are in school, it's no problem. So you have the same confusion here. It's no standard operating, you know, procedure to this. Very interesting. Biden's speech, he said, people of color, black, brown, Native American, and poor whites. Now, you could kind of say the Native American and the poor white, you know, there's a lot of white Native Americans. In my opinion, if you were born here and you're poor and you're white in the United States, you're a total failure. You deserve nothing. Yeah, you deserve nothing. I heard that same verbiage by the black Congressman Clyburn. He said, and she was talking about reparations, he said blacks, browns, Native Americans, and poor whites. And I said, are they trying to make poor whites a minority group? Taking away the private federal prisons is not going to fix the problem. The states with the private prisons that have contracts that have to keep them nearly 100% full, that's a huge part of the problem. The irony in all of it is that the law that created the private federal prisons to house all these new federally charged black drug dealers was written by Joe Biden. He did the prison law he co-authored the prison law and the bill that put them in jail. He also wrote the drug laws that extended their time so you could keep them longer in these private prisons. And then he gave black people disproportionate time, 101. So he pretty much said, you're only going to keep you. Now he just wants to take away the federal part. But what about the state part? He encouraged every state to follow that same aggressive policy by giving them $13 billion for free. If you accept these policies and implement them in your state, you can get this money. And they split the money up amongst all the states. And that's why we got drug courts and all this other stuff. Unbelievable. Three words, I heard these clips during the broadcast this evening that I think lead to confusion and deception because they're so broad, they're very vague, polysemous, equality, justice, and unity. To me, none of those things will address the problem because they're rigged. The police insurrection, the insurrection at the Capitol with the police pertaining in it. And now they're trying to make it seem like this is white supremacy, these people who did this insurrection. And now the police force with the white supremacy being spoken about. It was way back in 2006 when the FBI put out a report after years of investigating that the police forces throughout the whole entire United States was inundated with white supremacists at every level. So now all of a sudden, all of this is coming out and they're trying to purposely lead this into this Capitol thing, which, you could address that other part. You should have addressed it the first way. Now it's just they're doing some white supremacy right now. They're doing something that I think is either way. Police end up in Washington D.C. all the way from Seattle. That's amazing. But my question would be, what are you going to punish police now for supporting a political person running for office? Like, where does this stop? There was a clip that you also played where they were talking about the defunding the police. And that they said that was fascist. No, the defunding the police, that's an anti-fascist talking point. That's a huge part of anti-fascism. It's not a part of that. I just, don't see where they're going with all this. What are they going to do now? Make a MAGA hat comparable to the Confederate flag, you know, or comparable to the Nazi symbol? Like, how is this? It just doesn't make sense to me. They're doing something. They're practicing white supremacy. I haven't quite figured out what they're doing. What, you know, I'll mute my line, Josh. Thank you.
Much obliged. That was important. Much obliged, Thomas, in New York. That was important. President Biden, poor whites, black people, Native Americans, poor whites. Like, what? Wait a minute. That's what now? Poor whites? I told they always get the folks in Appalachia, like, whoo, they must have like all kinds of goodies that they are saving up for them. Like, poor white people. Mm. Another way of the conflation, that term, it'll normally be LGBTQ people or something of that, white women, poor whites. I guess that's another component way that they can do that in terms of causing confusion. But important, have to see how frequently that word unity. I try to avoid using that word as well. You can unify around a code. And I also am a big advocate of the United Independent concept, where we are not necessarily in what they call lockstep. We might not be in the same room. We might not be on the same continent, but we are working towards the same goal, replacing white supremacy with justice. That can be done in a lot of different ways. But yeah, I'm not that way too vague. Ask for lots of details when people start saying what we need to do is to unify. Unity. We got to get unity. So what do you mean? 720-716-7300. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Other folks that we have missed totally. If you have a hand up, commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Have you heard?
Greetings, caller in Florida.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to just the host, the listeners, and callers. My sympathy and empathy goes out to Mr. Rob in California. And also want to say rest in peace to the victims of racism who passed in the last week. I wanted to share a couple of things. I was thinking about when they were speaking about the race soldiers, I guess, having to question if they were to like something that was Trump related or something. Some kind of reports that were posted online or social media, would they get in trouble, or what's the threshold and everything? And, you know, I think that was interesting how they were trying to say, I guess most of the majority of them are conservative, and they just wasn't giving any definitions to what they meant and what context did they mean it in. And the victim, I think that might have been a victim that was talking about how, like, hey, this guy's a racist. He keeps getting these magazines, like what? Nah, he can't be a racist. And the guy just turned to saying that, yeah, the Jews are taking over everything. And, I think that was some kind of a code, because it did. I'm thinking that white person may have known that it would be people who are classified as black, non-white, that would eventually question him, and that's just what he had by default to use in response if he was questioned about it. And then he said, you know, he had to start thinking, like, man, he didn't say this, but that's why I think he was going, or what he was trying to lead to, that it could be any of them. How do I know? And you know, that's what I was thinking. So the suspicion. And I think this situation that went on with the Capitol, the, how they broke into the Capitol, property damage, vandalism, all kinds of criminal activity. And it does look like a lot of the white perpetrators, terrorists, don't seem to be getting charged or being given minimal charges and everything. And I just remember the term scrubbing was used. I think the guy said they went back to scrub. They were scrubbing their accounts. And I thought that was an interesting term, since scrubbing implies that a stain or something dark is needs to be cleaned, and clean usually in a lot of ads and different ways tends to associate with something light and white. And two last things. The guy that was asked about how can you, I guess, vet these white people coming into the military and finding out if they have this quote-unquote white nationalism. And I don't think he had to say all of that about logistics and the economy. Like, no, there's ways where you can do this, all this technology. So I think he just answered it with a lot of words, more than necessary for someone of his position. And I think he was practicing white supremacy. And I just wanted to end off with, there here locally, there was a commission meeting on the 29th a couple of days ago, where a white person at the city commission submitted a report for something that's supporting the Free the Nipple campaign. And it's about an ordinance that's going to allow females to go out in public topless. So some black people on the commission were greatly opposed to this, as I would be, but they were saying that, you know, this would support our trans and non-binary neighbors. So this has been a big topic here locally throughout the week, and I'll give the updates on what decisions are made in regards to it. And that's all I have to share. Thank you.
Wow. That's, the timing of that is interesting. Like, we're in the middle of the Rona. I don't know if that would be a top priority, like face masks, the school program, topless ordinance for being outside. Like, can we get the school thing and the face mask straight, and then we'll get to the topless thing? Like, with the metaphor, the back burner. Let's put that one on the back burner, and then, yes, we'll devote as much time as need be to the topless consideration in public. I will say, in Seattle, and we had to bring this up in teacher training for some reason, it is within Seattle proper. As long as you are not on private property or harassing anyone, you can be legally nude, not just topless. You can be totally nude in Seattle. And this was affirmed on one of the Seattle public radio sites. They had photographs and everything, I guess. I don't know why this came up, but recently. But yes, they affirmed that this is true. You do not have to have clothes on at all, as long as you're not, you know, fondling people and that type of thing. Anyway, when they talked about the scrubbing, so-called, important point, because generally you are cleaning things. Sometimes they even say whitening things when you scrub them, removing dirt. When they were talking about getting rid of perhaps incriminating social media posts, evidence, that type of thing, which we talk about neutralizing workplace racism to maybe not post that sort of content to begin with. The rule that was given was, if you wouldn't post this on your Sunday church bulletin board, don't post it online. Reasonable, I thought, to some degree. However, in my attempted family, I said, man, I think for my attempted family members, if you posted "replace white supremacy with justice," I think a number of my attempted family members would be offended if that was on Sunday, like bulletin board, like, hey, I did not come to see all of your radical, you know, race talk and everything. We came to praise and hear some songs from the choir. And that, well, what about Dr. King? I didn't come to hear about that either. Like, I think a number of my like that would qualify. We didn't come to hear that on the bulletin board either. So be kind of strict standards if that was, at least for me, the people that I know that go to church, that would be very, it would be not a whole lot on the bulletin board, on the Twitter feed, if that was going to be the standard that we're going to use. The disbelief portion when they were talking to the black male in the armed services, I thought that was, he did not want to believe. The fella told, he gets these magazines, this guy's a racist. What? No. Really? How often does it get like that? Is so common. They talk all the time about how every black person is, you know, just another little Al Sharpton and another little Rosa Parks. Like, we got just little revolutionaries everywhere. That has not been my experience at all. Like, that has been my experience. It hasn't really mattered geographically. Hey, this person is a racist. No way. You're making that up. It's in your head. What did he say? Nigger? Nah. Probably listens to rap music. I bet he likes Kanye West. Yeah, that's what it is. See? I have experienced that. Oh, it is very rare where I bump into a non-white person, black person, anyone, victim of white supremacy, and I think this white person is a racist. This is, you know, the evidence, what they did, what they said, blah, 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 blah. It is very rare. Wow, Gus, I agree. I think he's a racist too. Just shows you white people have done a very successful job. What is the way our program ends? Our conditioning has been conditioned. Let's see. Other folks that we have missed totally. If you have a hand up, commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Oh, hi, guess Gus and the callers, I've been experiencing some what we call racial shadow boxing. So the meaning of racial shadow boxing is when a non-white person is directly or indirectly charged with mistreating another non-white person. And kind of in my case, it's, I have a victim mother and I have a victim father and I have a victim sibling. So I'm in the situation where they're all, the racists are using all three of them, in particular my victim brother, who is in a tragic relationship. And it's just kind of interesting of the timing of when he met that white woman. Yes, please ring the bell. So ever since that time, you know, our relationship is, well, as you know, non-white people don't really have relationships, they have arrangements. So I'm just trying to cope with the arrangement the best that I can. So I just wanted to read something from Mr. Fuller's book, because you guys know that I love Mr. Fuller's information. So on page 184, it says, "What should you do to require respect?" The answer, respect and or self-respect, means that a person refuses to lie to himself or herself and is at all times willing to inform others that he or she refuses to lie to him or herself. Simply put, do not at any time tell yourself to believe something that you know is not true. So right now I'm just accessing my and I'm telling myself the truth about the things that are happening to me under the system of white supremacy. And I'm going back to the racial shadow boxing. I experience a lot of racial shadow boxing, both at home and at work. And it's usually, I suspect that it's a suspected white supremacist, whether it be male or female, and they're classified as white. And sometimes they will use other non-white people to mistreat me. So then what I have to do, I have to go into codification. I have to use compensatory counter-racist logic. And that is the logic that came with the universe. So what that means is using codification in a way in any area of people activity, which in this case is the area of politics. So people relations. So a lot of the times I have to be really calm, you know, when I'm coping, when I'm speaking to my victim mother or my victim brother, or when they are being tacky or trashy or terroristic. I also detect that there are times when I am also being tacky, trashy, and terroristic with my victim, unit. Yeah, so it's really challenging. I just want to thank you guys for hearing me out, and thank you very much for hearing me.
Much obliged, victim in Canada. We're talking about the schools up there. We do wrap the program up saying, try as best we can to be patient with other victims of white supremacy. Try to be patient with ourselves. That is said for a reason. And even just to pause now, take what our victim in Canada just said, you know, difficulties with his attempted family members. And, you know, it's not as harmonious as we would like things to be. Attempted family. I've been saying that word quite a bit during the programs. Excuse me. And then you take what Rob, all the way in California, said, where his attempted family didn't even believe serious medical conditions. And you're making it up. You're fabricating things. That is the result of white supremacy racism, where we just have totally disrupted attempted families. That's why we want to go ahead and try to get this problem solved as soon as possible, because none of these arrangements, none of these relationships is going to be quality until we solve this problem. It's just going to be more of the same. But just to hear that repeatedly with so many different folks all over the world who talk about having, even amongst their own family members, can't even discuss racism, white supremacy. Can't do. Pam talked about the exact same thing. Can't even go and talk about this problem with my siblings. Why? In a tragic arrangement. That is how successful racist man, racist woman, racist child have been and continue to be. We have lots of work to do. Other folks, did we miss anybody? Is anybody that has a hand up that we missed totally? We are almost done. So if you have a thought suggestion to share, make sure we didn't miss anyone.
Gus, could I add something?
I reckon. Looks like we didn't miss anybody.
I could say something, right, Gus?
Yes, sir.
Oh, thank you, sir. Sorry, I don't want to interrupt you. I just want to thank the COW listeners in particular, like the veteran COW listeners. I really do miss Pam, the one that passed away, I think it was 2018. She was one of the person that I really, really wanted to speak with and continue to hear her voice. There's another gentleman, there's a caller from Florida. I don't know if he was the gentleman that asked Mr. Fuller many, many years ago about the word nigger. And then he asked about loneliness. And I don't know if it was him who asked that, but that question has really helped me because I feel like I'm really lonely a lot of the times. And Mr. Fuller says that this is something that's going to happen. And I really appreciate that he asked that question because I once in a while come back and I go back and I listen to what Mr. Fuller said to him, in particular what the caller from Florida, the gentleman said, and it's been really helpful. I want to thank you guys, really. I really appreciate it.
Much obliged. 12 years. Pam is missed. Pamela Evans Harris. I think she would agree with Rob in California. Your health is super important. I know we talked about, in fact, she was talking about plant-based eating like years before Gus T even thought like, oh, wait a minute, maybe I should put these chicken nuggets down. Put those potato chips down. Have some celery. Get some carrots, some beets. She was already talking about that and the importance of your health, eating correctly. So, Pamela Evans Harris, Miss, we talked about Chicago quite a bit tonight, and she resided in the Chicago area for a number of years. Our resident expert on Chicago matters, Pamela Evans Harris. Definitely missed. Let's see. I guess we did our 3 hours. Much obliged for folks' participation. I guess that's one thing. I don't know the age range, but it would probably work either way. I'd said this about the O.J. Simpson case. Like, that's one way that you can perhaps talk to some of our estranged relatives, or particularly if we have attempted family members who are resistant to speaking truthfully about racism, sometimes watching television. Let's watch the FX series on O.J. Simpson. Let's watch the ESPN documentary on O.J. Simpson, particularly if they're informed, like if you're watching it with a parent, grandparent, somebody like that, and they watched all of this, or you can just talk to them. If they watched the trial, chat about that. That's one way where you could talk about racism. If you have younger folks, they didn't see all that, you could do that as well. You could also apply this to the late Cicely Tyson. I'm certain if you have grandparents, aunts, if your parents are older, I'd say if they are over the age of 60, like, ooh-wee, like, they know about some Cicely Tyson. Like, I bet you could talk quite a bit about Sounder and her whole body of work in terms of the films that she was in and, you know, what they thought, her hair, all of that, like that right there. Huge way, or I would suspect one way that you could talk about racism, white supremacy with them. Then if you have younger children or what have you, they don't know who she is. Let's pick one of these. The Rosa Parks story. This is Cicely Tyson, the woman that they're talking about right now, black female that they're talking about right now. This is who this person is and why they say, hey, what she did is important. She lived all this time. 96 years, this is what she did with the time that she had and her talent. Sounder. Talk about that. That's another one right there. Black families in disarray. Sounder. White people to blame. We can watch that one and do have your child write a report. They got to do all that stuff for the virtual learning. We can watch Sounder write a report. You could watch the Rosa Parks story. Write a report. Go right down the autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman. Write a report. How does that relate to the current Black Lives Matter or racism? Lots of different ways. But yeah, lots of ways that you can use what's happening right now to maybe talk to and have some healthy dialogue with attempted family members about racism. With that, we will wrap things up. Unpleasant week, but as Dr. Welsing said, be not discouraged. We have a cosmic assignment. Race soldiers, they certainly are not going to take any vacations. They will just get ready to do more. That said, we'll be here at minimum on Thursday for the book club. Just check Facebook, Black Talk Radio Network, for all of the updates. If we have guests on before the book club this coming Thursday, Black History Month, no less. Much obliged for folks who participated live or listened to the archives. Hope it was worth your time and energy. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. We started the program. I mentioned James Craig Anderson, who was killed, ran over in 2011. Henry Tapia was killed just days ago in Massachusetts. Both of these were road incidents, and particularly Henry Tapia, as I said, they're, you know, labeled this so-called road rage. You do not want to be under the influence and then have a situation like that happen where you can't really process things accurately, efficiently, to make the best decision. We're in a system of white supremacy. You might have to make a life-saving decision quickly. If you are impaired, might mean the difference between being alive or not. That's serious. Sobriety would be best. In addition to being sober, I'm still hunkered down. I could just repeat the names I just said: James Craig Anderson, Henry Tapia. Lots of reasons to hunker down. The Rona. Many reasons. If you are going out, something serious, taking care of your offspring, job, whatever else that's serious, be very alert. Henry Tapia. Monitor what's happening around you. If it looks like somebody is being aggressive, if you're driving and they're, you know, cursing and doing all the rest of it, slow down, let them go. Get the license, you know, information so you can make a report, but do not antagonize. Do not say a word. Slow down. Distance. That's what we should be thinking. Distance. I think they teach that in defensive driving school. Distance. Not antagonizing any of these folks. They may be armed. We're not escalating. Certainly, no verbal altercations. I've been saying that all year. I just saw that with Henry Tapia, but no verbal altercations. If you did not leave your residence prepared for mortal combat, exit. That's what you should be thinking. Minimizing risk. I'm going to get out of here. If you need to, or if you want to call enforcement officers, what have you, you can do that as you're exiting, but it should be all about minimizing risk. You don't know if this person is armed. You don't know if they have a whole crew of armed white people with them who are ready for mayhem. Antifa, right wing, whatever you want to call it. You didn't leave the house with an armed entourage. Exit. No verbal confrontations. All of that said, sober, alert, driver or passenger, you're buckled. If you're driving, you're not on the cell phone. Again, we need to be very aware of what is happening around us. Two, we're just trying as best we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. Man, any little thing that we can do, being sober, being buckled, not on the cell phone, just little things that we can do. Incidentally, they mentioned in the context of that police report, they mentioned the worst act of domestic terrorism being Timothy McVeigh. I get Tulsa, Black Wall Street, I'm not sure. But they said Timothy McVeigh, 1995. That is one of the few incidents that displaced the O.J. Simpson trial as the front page media material in April 1995. I would not have connected those two events, but again, Stephen Singular, hey, Timothy McVeigh, Mark Furman, they're just two different examples of the same white domestic terrorism, and they both hang out in Idaho and both seem to be influenced by ideas like the Turner Diaries. Timothy McVeigh, Mark Fuhrman, almost simultaneous in history, April 1995. Mark Fuhrman had just got off the witness stand for the first time. Context is everything. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. No name calling in the 10 stops, no name calling, and preserve your health. It is one of the most important things we have. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.